Okay. We're back on the record. Our next witness is Bill Connor. Mr. Connor, do you understand any testimony you give today will be under oath?
Yes.
Okay. Please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give in the matter now pending will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
For the record, would you state your name, spelling your last name, please?
My name is William Connor. My last name is C-O-N-N-O-R.
Okay. I'm going to change my seat, let the record show that we have a visual presentation, and I believe I'm going to turn the direct questioning over to Eric Forcier. Is that correct, Mr. Forcier?
Correct.
Okay.
Our intention is to let him go through the beginning portion of the slides, and then we'll get into some more questioning by me around halfway through. But to begin with, I asked him to prepare how audits work, the process work, how does it start, what an audit is, and you'll see some slides to that effect. But we're essentially going to let him have the floor explaining what he does.
Before we do that, yes, for the record, who prepared this visual presentation?
I prepared the visual presentation, and I had Mr. Connor verify the numbers and the contents of, but we worked together to get this where it is today, but I'm the one who physically prepared it.
Okay, thank you. Please proceed.
As I stated, my name is William Connor. I am the CPA that conducted the audits for Financial Resources for the years 1999 through 2008. I've been a CPA since 1985. I've been in public practice since 1983, where I worked for two large local firms here until 1989, where I then went off into started my own practice in the fall of 1989. So I guess the whole thing here is what is an audit? What did I do for Financial Resources? And the information on the next few slides basically takes the information that's right off an audit report that that CPAs provide for clients. And basically, we conduct our audits in accordance with generally accepted auditing standards. And those auditing standards have changed since 1999 through where we are today, but basically, those standards make it so that we plan and perform the audits to obtain reasonable assurance about whether the financial statements are free of material statements. So the planning involves, and I can probably go to the next slide here, and I'll speak to the planning here. The planning goes to basically to get information to understand the flow of transactions, to understand the internal controls over the financial records that the client has, and then based upon that information that we obtain is then to design our audits based upon the risk areas that we perceive, to then obtain information by examining on a test basis to support the amounts and disclosures in the financial statements. So primarily the emphasis on the reports are is that we are planning the audits, yes, to focus on the areas that we perceive as risk areas, but we are testing the documents. We are not absolutely looking at every piece of information that is included in the companies.
If I may interject here, Mr. Connor.
Yep.
When we spoke about this in the past, you had mentioned to me the various different types of an audit being the most scrutinized look at the company. And could you go over the various types of?
Right. Basically, when a company engages normally a CPA like myself, they're looking for attestation services. And the lowest level is what's called a compilation, which is basically the accountant or the CPA is basically assembling the information and putting the reports, the financial reports, in the proper form and format. They absolutely do no verification. There is absolutely no other work except for arranging the financial statements in a proper form and format. A review is the next level of attestation services, which basically it's a little bit more than a compilation, where the CPA is making inquiries and performing analytical services to determine and give limited amounts of assurances that the numbers and the disclosures are adequate. An audit steps up to the highest level that we perform, whereas we have to have that understanding of the internal controls of the company. We have to understand the flow of the controls. We have to then design our and plan the audit so that we gather evidence on a test basis so that we hit the areas that we believe are high risk areas so that we can finally boil all that evidence issue a statement that says we believe these statements are reasonably stated, are not misstated.
Now, why did you perform an audit, the highest level, for financial resources?
Mr. Farrer contacted our, and he was looking for a CPA back in 1999-2000 because he needed to, what he told myself was he needed this for an FHA license. And to be able to have an FHA license, he needed to produce this, otherwise, and he had to meet certain criteria in order for him to then on the audit still to have his FHA license.
And to you, what is an FHA license?
It's by a Federal Home Association. It's one of the standards normally for people that are selling residential mortgages that would be required for them to sell in the secondary markets those.
Did he ever indicate to you that he needed this audit also to comply with any banking regulations?
No. I mean, that became apparent as the years went by. When they would come in, it became more apparent as he was trying to push myself to get the audits done quicker, because if you went and looked at the field work dates on these actual audit reports, a lot of the reports were done June, July, August, September of the succeeding year. So if we were doing a 1999 audit, we may have done that in somewhere in the summer or June or whatever, but the dates varied. And then what happened is, as he was having his reviews with the banking commissioners, he would then push in certain years, we've got to get this done by March or April. But most of the audits that I did were, I would call them non-busy season audits, where I was outside of March, April, and May.
Okay.
Yep. All right, I got to get the pointer back here. There it goes. Uh-oh. Go to sleep.
You quite did it, didn't
you? Oh, was there we go. So one of the things that is required of every audit is that we obtain an engagement letter. And this is a sample engagement letter. All the years that are in question or the audits that I perform, we had separate engagement letters. They do change over the years because the profession, going back to 99 to where we are now, whereas we used to have one or two page engagement letters, now they're four pages. It's kind of hard to see here, but and it is fairly explicit. The areas that I wanted to point out, naturally, is if you could read down in this area here, which says our procedures in audit includes just testing the transactions. That's the part that I mentioned that's in the report. It's not an absolute audit where we are going through every transaction, nor are we looking at every transaction as if we were professional to render that an opinion on that specific part of it. The other part of it is over here, which is quite interesting, but it's back to a perception issue that's occurred over the years. Is it even goes on to explain, and if you wish you could read that top part, but it says, because an audit is designed to provide reasonable but not absolute assurance, and because we will not perform a detailed examination of all transactions, there is a risk that material misstatements may exist and not be detected by us. In addition, an audit is not designed to detect immaterial misstatements or violations of laws or government regulations that do not have a direct and material effect on the financial statements. So, and it goes on in the last three paragraphs to really explain in the engagement letter, these financial statements are not ours. These are your financial statements. It's the client's responsibility to have their records available to us. It's the client's responsibility to record all the transactions. It's the client's responsibility to take ownership of whatever's presented to us. I'll go to the next slide, let's see if I get this. And again, here is when you get to page 3, it gets into some of the explanations, more of the contractual parts of saying what we're going to do, and this paragraph here that's towards the top explains, and that's what's a new requirement. If we're going to do anything else besides the audit work, we have to explain if we're doing bookkeeping or making adjustments. Like in this case, financial resources pretty much had a simple accounting system where they recorded everything on a cash basis. So all the transactions, all the amounts that were deposits were recorded, all the expenses were recorded. But they didn't put the books on on an accrual basis, which is a generally accepted accounting principle, until the end of the year. So we would help the client look and assemble their accrual entries to then put them on a formal accrual basis. But this is just specifically what we're required now to maintain our independence, saying, look, whatever adjustments we propose, whatever work we do, it's still up to you. You need to make sure the somebody that's assigned that records those transactions, because we won't be recording those transactions.
How often do you see, in your experience, companies using a cash basis?
Most clients that are small clients will use a cash basis. Most clients, and again, under $5 million in sales, you know, if you look at the typical commercial client, they understand cash basis fairly well. They don't understand accrual basis unless they get to the point of having a CPA on staff or whatever. Accrual basis is an accounting term, I guess. I'll leave it.
Did you consider financial resources at this time and assistance of the Lakes region? Did you consider them to be a small business based on what you've seen?
Yes.
And is that because you consider them to have under $5 million in, what was it you said?
$5 million in sales.
Is that what you use to determine that you consider in your mind them to be a small business?
No.
There's
sophisticated accounting systems, not sophisticated accounting systems. I mean, you can have a $2 million manufacturer that would be a very complicated entity that you couldn't run it on a cash basis. When you look at what, if you have a manufacturing or a construction company where there are large amounts of receivables, large amounts of payables, construction contracts in process, or inventory in process moving from raw materials into production and out, that is a complex accounting type of organization that requires complex books and records. In it, what his business, being a brokerage business, is typical a cash basis type of business. Whether it's a mortgage broker, a real estate broker, generally speaking, what you have is you have cash that comes in from a transaction, and then you have expenses you're paying. So in his case, you know, his accrual adjustments would be, okay, do you have any commissions that are outstanding? And then the other part would be accrual adjustments would be, do you have any payables? And in his business, primary payables would be, do you third-party payables like either lawyers, accountants? You would have other parts of payables would be if he had, you know, he's having numerous amounts of valuations done because of the natural, you've got to do that part of when you're doing a mortgage loan. So you'd have those professionals who would do the valuations or whatever else. So the amount of payables that he had to keep track of was not normally that large. So again, it gets back to, you know, can a $10 million company run on a cash basis? If there's not a lot of assets that are involved in the production of the income, where it tends to be an easier system to maintain and to understand. So this is, again, one of the pieces of that we are required in every audit, and we receive that in every audit, is, and it's part of the engagement letter, is a management representation letter. At the conclusion of when we do all the audit and do all our evidence gathering, we give this to the client that basically is signed by management that tells us that they're supposed to represent that there aren't anything. They made available all the records that pertaining to the company. There is no fraud that occurred. They are in compliance with federal laws and regulations. In particular, on the management rep letter, we added a couple things over the progression of this particular audit, because when we started this audit in 99 and 2000, there were no issues with the Bureau of Securities. In 2001, they came in, and what they found was that there were some unrecorded preferred shareholders, along with account holders that had not been recorded. So what we put in the rep letters going forward for that was a positive confirmation. I think 16 and 14, which might be on the next. I think they are right.
Next slide. Yeah.
Ugh. Need a mouse pad. Which 14 and 16, we have complied with all aspects, and I probably can read it better from here. No, it's now, yeah, 14. All stock transactions are properly presented within the accompanying financial statements. All stock records are maintained by management, not maintained by outside parties. The company complied with the Securities and Exchange Commission rules regarding the sale of securities. Number 17 on this one is the company has not issued any preferred or common stock during the year ended December 31st, 2008, and has not issued any debt instruments or guaranteed any obligations of the company stock with other entities. So those specific ones were included by myself to make sure that I was putting Scott Farrer on notice that you're signing off representing that you have not engaged in any more of the issues that are occurred.
Let me interrupt for just a second.
Sure.
And you have a signed management representation letter for every year for your annual audit, is that correct?
Correct.
Signed by Scott Farrer, is that correct?
Yep.
And subsequent to 2000, those particular caveats appeared in every one of the representation letters?
Yeah, that I'm aware of. I mean, the records I have is we have a record retention policy for federal purposes. We follow the A-133 requirements. We do some nonprofits where I only keep my records for 5 years.
Okay. So the best of your recollection is that appeared universally and on an annual basis?
Correct.
And the best of your recollection is that in that period of time, he did sign the management representation letter.
Right. There, and again, we're going to click on to the next thing.
Would you ever have proceeded with an audit if you didn't have that?
We couldn't issue the statements, no.
Okay.
There are three real things that we have to have to complete an audit, assuming I'm going to get through peer review and not, and you know, be basically given an adverse opinion on my review of my audits. You have to have an engagement letter, you have to have a management rep letter, and you have to have a legal letter.
Okay.
So, which you're gonna see one of those documents coming up too.
As I understand it, that management representation letter is issued after you physically go look at the books and compile your reports.
It's at
release the report until.
That's correct. That's at the end of the engagement after we have accumulated. Technically, the management representation letter, because it's referring to his financial statement, should go out and always does. Once they've been given, there's a draft of the financial statements because they can't. So you can't give this letter at the beginning because they haven't seen, or if you haven't finished your adjustments, they haven't seen the final product.
There was one other letter that we talked about that was with the engagement and management representation letters. That was a legal letter. We don't have a sample included here, but can you explain what the legal...
I'm not sure. What's the next page in this? Maybe we do have one.
I don't believe we included an example of it.
Yeah. What happens is a legal letter basically is anybody that's involved in litigation, and we had some and you did look at them, we circularized the lawyers. So if there happens to be the main attorney, which is handling the litigation, we would send out a letter saying, okay, we understand you've been engaged to be the attorney. Can you get back to us to tell us what the status is? Are there any pending threatened or pending lawsuits or any ongoing lawsuits that need to be, in our mind, disclosed? What we're looking for there is that there may be an obligation, and that's the reason why we ask for those legal letters back. There may be an obligation back if there's a settlement that's underway or a possible lawsuit that's going to be suing the organization for millions of dollars. We have to then review those legal letters to determine whether we need to book them, whether we need to disclose them, or whether it's okay not to do either. And I'll just give you the quick rundown on that. If it's probable, when we get these legal letters back and the lawyer says, look, we have the suit going on, we're being sued for $1 to $2 million, and it looks like it's probable we're going to lose this case. If that's given in the narrative, then I have to book the liability. If it's an amount that says we're being sued by $1 to $2 million, we're actively defending the case, and we think we're going to win, then I'm just going to disclose that. If it says that this is a frivolous suit, we believe it's going to be discharged, then I just would write on mine, and you would see, if you look at my letters, it'd say, okay, no disclosure required.
So when you say disclose, where would that disclosure be located?
It would be in the footnotes to the financial statements that are accompanying the financials.
Do you recall which attorneys you would send that letter to, the legal letter?
Yeah, there would be the primary one would be Gould. Gould and Burke was their primary person. The other one that they used was Sullivan, that did a lot of their closings, which was down on the seacoast. And the other one was Gallagher, was Dennis Maloney over Gallagher Gartrain, who was the securities lawyer that was involved from 2001 onwards.
Okay.
they did engage an attorney out in the West for the large NIR case that they had, and that went through Gould. So Gould would comment on that particular attorney and what was going on that, because he was managing that attorney.
In general, when, and I understand that many of the letters went to Gould and Burke and some others as well, but the majority of them wouldn't go to Gould and Burke?
Every year.
Every year.
Gould and Burke was every year. Sullivan was primarily every year. Gallagher was every year.
Okay. And
except for prior to 2001 when the SEC, Gallagher wasn't on board at that point in time.
And when you sent the letters to those three entities, do you recall their summarization of the pending lawsuits to be accurate over time? Meaning,
sure,
you've got a 1 year, you would obviously see that what transpired in that lawsuit and whether or not they were accurate. What is your opinion on?
Right. I mean, and even over that the period of time, there was only two or three lawsuits, and they were fairly large. There was the Ronnie Stone lawsuit that was out there that was in for a couple of years. There was the SEC, when we were working through, there would be Gallagher commenting on what the status was, because I always was concerned about the potential, because naturally, if you're violating securities, you could be fined for that. So we were looking to find out whether there's a liability for that. So that would have been that point. The other part was getting an update on the NIR litigation, because that was a very large receivable that was out there at the beginning, which then wound its way through the courts and ended up with a Supreme Court judgment. You know, so that one went through, that was probably 3 or 4 years that they were talking about that. So there's the, off the top of my head, there's a Grundin is another person that it had sued.
Hannigan?
Yeah, that one, yeah. And so there's only about 3 or 4 suits that were mentioned throughout that period of time. And there was a couple of frivolous suits that were mentioned where somebody was suing because of misrepresentation. But there wasn't like 40 suits ongoing. There was 3 or 4.
But you found the representations made by the three different attorneys you mentioned to be accurate over time as
yep.
the assessments of the different pending lawsuits?
Yep.
When you refer to the SEC a couple of times now, are you referring to our
Bureau, yes, New Hampshire Bureau of Securities, yes.
Okay.
Not the federal SEC, no.
Okay. And when you had that in your management representation letter, you wrote SEC, but you meant the dealings with the
New Hampshire Bureau of Securities,
okay.
Yes.
Okay. Please continue.
Make this come alive. Well, the pointer shows up on mine. Here we go. This is, all right. And so as part of this is just evidence. This is a typical confirmation we sent out. The way financial resources worked, it was kind of back to its simplistic system, okay? And we'll show you as we come forward. The major categories of income on financial resources was commissions, commercial, commissions, residential, and then there was a catch-all large category called mortgage income. Included in that mortgage income category, the primary source were, and again, it was good and it had the system, it would list the person. So a lot of what was mortgage income were my belief, were private lenders. So you would see an individual name come through and it would be a deposit for $250,000 or $300,000 listed by the name. The flip side of their accounting system was the expense side of it, and there was two major categories there. The biggest category called that he grouped everything called mortgage expenses. And the majority of the amounts of money that were being paid there were, again, to individual lenders. It would be made out to individual payees. There was another large category, and we'll see it as there's some good slides coming up, which gives some condensed information that was to interest expense. So he had a large category of 1099 interest expense. Those were, from the beginning, where I was stressing were the high-risk areas of this audit, because my fear or my belief would be, if it's all mortgage income and we have people coming in, is this really income or is it an obligation of the company? So along with, if we have mortgage expense that we're paying these individuals, why are we paying these individuals? Are these payments on loans that have been made or deposits that have come in or loans where financial resources is obligated back to these individuals? So each year I circularize anywhere from 10 to 15 individuals asking them, and you can read, It got to the point, and a typical one, it read, and again, what I was confirming is the income or expense recorded properly on financial resources books, or are these obligations to you? So these went out independently to these individuals, which then come back to my office independently. And basically, it was confirming as of the end of the particular year, financial resources is not obligated to repay the amount that was advanced by you in exchange for an unrelated mortgages during the year ended, whatever the year was. Financial Resources Inc. has not guaranteed or provided additional security for the amounts that have been advanced to Financial Resources. Financial Resources Inc. acts only as an agent on your behalf, whereby it collects note payments and correspondingly pays you under the unrelated note terms. If the notes that you purchase goes into default or foreclosure, Financial Resources is not liable for any shortage that may result from the default or foreclosure. So, and these changed a little bit. There's some of the other ones I also then expanded in the subsequent years to include contingently obligated in any case, because my fear is when I was reporting on this income, is it really income or is it an obligation? And all these letters that came through each year came back clean, signed by the individual saying, no, they're not obligations. These amounts are basically private loans that Financial Resources acted as an agent for.
So in all the years that you were there in those books, 99 to 08, did you ever receive a confirmation back that was inconsistent with the reason why you sent it?
No, and the selection process was not based upon them setting the criteria of who you can send out confirmations to. Each year what I would do, they would run off their books, would be who the largest people were. And then those largest people, I would just ask and get their address or whatever, and we confirm the amount. So we were not restricted, and, you know, you can't send one out to this person, that person, that person, that person, because, you know, it was always right. I did the work to determine who we were going to select.
You chose the recipient of that letter.
Yeah. And they were the largest lenders.
Right.
Are there any other criteria you use to determine who to send these to other than the largest transaction?
No, primarily what I was looking at is to stratify. If I could send out 10 confirmations and get 60 to 70% of the revenue that came in, that gave me made me feel good. If I can get back that many in many confirmations and still have that many amount, that percentage of receipts be confirmed, then I can, that's good enough evidence to move on to conclude that they were properly recorded.
Is 60 to 70% of the receivables being confirmed an accurate approximation of?
Yeah, sometimes it was even higher than that, yeah.
But yes. Was it ever lower in your opinion during those years?
No. Towards the end, it was interesting because in 2008 in particular, a lot of the funds were funneling through Scott Ferrer. So there was, when you look at the years that go by, and maybe we can go into, so in 1999-2000, Financial Resources is doing a little bit of everything. They're doing small business loans, they're factoring receivables, they're buying and selling second mortgages, they're doing direct lending, they have participation notes ongoing, and this is for the 99, 2000, 2001 years is what their type of business was. And then when the Bureau got involved, In the discussions that between Dennis and Scott, and I was involved with a couple meetings.
Dennis who?
Dennis Maloney from Gallagher, attorney there. It became apparent that they needed to clean up what they were doing in terms of, and from that point on, what you would see in looking at the books of records, and you'd be able to see it when we look at graphically, the participation notes, which was part of the issues with the Bureau, they were liquidated. The selling and buying and factoring was moved off. The whole goal became, at that point in time, was to make Financial Resources Mortgage a brokerage firm and not to be doing these things. And then part of the impetus was because the securities exchange was all over him about buying out the participant notes, the accounts that he had, the preferred shareholders, because he wasn't supposed to issue those.
Could you just explain to us what you mentioned a couple of times, factoring and factoring receivables. Elaborate what that means.
Right. And he had a couple of them, but the largest one he had, which you'll see here, is Creative Couriers. They were a courier that brought luggage from the airlines and delivered it to lost luggage. And what he would do is for points, 5 points or whatever, he would take his receivables and at any particular month and advance him funds up to 95%, 90% of that, and then Financial Resources would be responsible to collect those receivables. So he's charging him a fee. And over a time, what happened, unfortunately, with Creative Couriers is their business kind of changed and they got behind, and Financial Resources at that point in time also had the first mortgage on this individual's home. It basically, and we'll see where that goes, but basically he was factoring that particular business. He had a couple of other ones. He was doing small business loans like that too.
And this is all around 2001?
I mean, it went 2001, 2002, and then by the time, you know, 2002 happens, that's all in the process. From 2002 is kind of a two-year window where nothing happens to buy these people out. But the business was primarily, when you look at the receipts, it's all from direct lending from that point on where the receipts are from individuals. As the years go by, the 2008, a lot of the deposits were coming through as Farah. Scott Farah was making the deposits. There were wires that he was making. And his representation to me was these are all deals he was doing, and he was paying the company for their providing him resources, almost like a management fee in 2008. Because you can see wire, Scott Farah. If you looked at the actual receipts in 2008, it's a much higher percentage than direct lenders. Whereas in 2005, if you looked at all the receipts, it would just be other unrelated third-party names where there would be deposits coming from.
Did it indicate where the wire was coming from?
No.
It just indicated incoming wire?
Right.
So you, okay.
Right. Well, and it wasn't a wire between the accounts. So, he had one bank account that he used for Financial Resources. There was when he had the Ronnie Stone issue, they had frozen and got an attachment, frozen one bank account. There was one year in particular he had two bank accounts going, and he closes out the new bank and goes back to doing business at Citizens. So he used one bank account. So he didn't, Financial Resources, as far as I know, never had a multitude. There was one primary bank account. He had another smaller account that was for servicing, but there was no activity that went, very, very little activity went through that account. But he didn't have 12 accounts or 10 accounts that were in Financial Resources.
If in 2008 you said you'd seen a lot of wires that were coming in under Scott Farah individually, how did you schedule conference that year on those major transactions?
Well, I mean, I'm confirming with him, it's through his management rep letter, what the fees are for. So he's confirming to me directly that's revenue and where it's being earned from. It becomes difficult. I mean, the same thing, and that's what we talked about. How do you orchestrate this? You can create a shell that's just earning management fees, and the management fees may be coming from some other third party that we don't know from, or however he's getting that from. And then it becomes, well, it's just income that's between me and the company. So you end up recording that. It's still revenue.
So I understand you confirmed those wire transfers with Scott because it came from Scott. Are you required to go anything beyond, I think you said there were generally accepted auditing standards. Do they require you to go anywhere beyond, especially if it's the president of the company who's taking in all the money in this scenario?
Well, beyond the documentation that he gives you that this is income and where it's coming from, where else do you go? You know, I mean, and the other part is what I look to then try to say, okay, where are the wires coming from, so I can determine where the wires are coming from. And you know what I mean? That to find out, I want to trace these wires to find out whether it's coming from another third party or whatever. That wouldn't be a normal auditing step that you would do. It may be something you would do in a fraud audit, but this is not a fraud audit. This is just a general financial statement audit. Now, the other part of it is, if I would have suspected he committed fraud, maybe I would want to go to a next level on that, but not under normal auditing standards would you do that.
So from 99 to 08, did you ever reach that next level where you saw potential fraud?
No.
Okay, please continue.
Right, we kind of dived into this. This is kind of generic of what we were just talking about, where they derived. The biggest part of the model changed too. In 2005, 2005, 2006, and then going into 2007, there was a couple things. But he basically changed his business model, whereas if you look at 99, 2000, 2001, 2002, most, even up to 2004, most of the direct lending are, I would consider, small direct lending, $200,000, $100,000, $300,000. There was a couple of people that were involved that had larger amounts that they had advanced. Rachel Chang being one of those that at any one given time she may have been advancing $500,000, $600,000, $700,000, $800,000, but most of them were small. What he decided to do was to build and go more national, where he saw, I guess, the real money to be made was on the commercial side, and that's where he spent a lot of resources in probably 05, 06, 07, developing the website business, which would be third-party commercial loans, where he would be. What he showed me was packages. Okay, I got these properties in Maine. The loan to value ratios are 50%, and I need to go get, in essence, bridge loans for these folks. And then he would put those on his internet and you can get investors. But all those transactions, the only thing the financial resources was doing was recording brokerage fee or brokerage income from. So none of the proceeds from any of those loans were coming through financial resources. So when I went and tested a lot of the transactions or several of the transactions, you would look and you would see, here's the commission for $30,000. You'd find that it would be recorded as a deposit on financial resources. But the closing proceeds were not going there. They were going to, I believe, CLNM. That's where most of the closing proceeds were going.
When did you become aware of CLNM?
CLNM, maybe I'll jump to a couple part of this, okay?
Sure.
I don't know if you want to talk about numbers or you want to wait to talk about numbers.
We can get to CLNM later and you can begin with the balance sheet. I know we addressed CLNM in greater detail.
Yeah, it's coming.
So we'll wait for that and just please continue here.
All right. So these are summarized numbers that came from the audited financial statements. This is just the balance sheet highlights, or it says balance sheet, but here we have kind of, I'd call it, you got assets, liabilities. It's also got the revenue. So you got the income statement highlights here too. So basically you can see the assets grow and then they go down. And primarily if you looked at the underlying assets in 2002, most of those assets are not cash. Most of those assets are notes receivable. And with the highest part coming in 2005, and the majority of the notes receivable a couple of them were non-related, but the biggest one in 04, 05, or actually 05, is a note receivable, which I'll get into, which is from the sale of two mortgages to CLNM in 2005. But basically, there were some participation notes, and there were the largest amounts in the early years until we finally we liquidate the participation notes. So by the time you get to 2006 and 2007, the balance sheet, there is really not a lot there. It is cash, it is commissions receivable, and it's operating assets. There are no real loans on the books. The only thing that's on the books as a loan in 2007, 2008 is what's left to the NIR receivable, which had a corresponding loss reserve of 125. There's a $250,000 receivable at that point in time in 2007 and 2008. So there are no real hard assets as this thing evolves. The biggest part of them were participation notes, and that was one of the areas where the Bureau said we had to liquidate our portions, and we'll see a slide that actually we confirmed when that was finally done with Gallagher's office. Long-term debt, there was never really any long-term debt in this company. It was not debt financed. In 2001, which is quite interesting, I don't think you see it here, you may see it in the next slide, we had to go back and restate 2001 when the Bureau came involved, because there was, was it 1.5? Do you remember?
1.3, you're talking about preferred shareholders?
Preferred shareholders, 1.3 of preferred shareholders that hadn't been on the books. We'll get to another slide coming up that'll kind of, and you can see the peak revenue here, and we'll explain what happens in, or I'll explain what happens in 2005, where the revenue goes up. Let's go to the next one. And again, here's the detail of what I was just talking to you. There's never really a lot of cash within this company. Current portions of notes receivable, you can see 2003, 2004, that note is the Creative Courier notes receivable that he had booked at that point in time, which gets sold to CLM in 2005 for $730,000. So.
That's a significant transaction, and we're going to go over the Creative Courier transaction as well as another note sold to CLM. There's two big notes that were sold very soon after the inception of CLM.
But you can also see what I was talking about earlier, the participation notes receivable here. 2001, 2002 is kind of a lull, and it spikes in 2005, but that's only because of the receivable that was booked from a CLM transaction that ends up getting paid off in full in 2006. So that was in the process of being liquidated in 05 and 06.
And if you look on the third row down, it says current portion of notes receivable. The next one under there is giving me all trouble all week. It's supposed to say unsecured. So the portion of unsecured. So
right.
Just to clarify that.
Okay.
But that also goes to what I spoke to earlier. We were doing a lot of little things. And by the time we get to really the end of 2002, we're not, financial resources are not being used to service or to be involved with participation loans or whatever. And I believe that was in direct relation to the securities exchange telling them not to do it. So he's no longer doing it there.
Can you explain to me again what notes receivable related party is and why, in your opinion, they dropped to zero?
Well, those amounts related party was insurance options, which there were amounts that he was advancing to insurance options. And they were just unrecorded, there wasn't a lot of terms to them. So it got to the point in 2004 where the balance had built up to $115,000, and I wrote it off in 2005 because there was no payments coming back from that company. That was insurance options.
So in sum, can you just go through each row and tell us which ones were cleaned up, in your opinion, due to the Bureau of Securities?
Well, really all the assets. So the participation loans were part of the agreement. We had to liquidate the participation loans, so that one was. The preferred shareholders also had kind of an interesting thing. Preferred shareholders, at least two of the primary ones were they invested, I believe, their IRA money or their retirement money by buying preferred shares and into financial resources. And then what they orchestrated back out was Scott would then draw up unsecured loans to them and advance them funds. So what you had is there was two or three of them which were on both ends. They had invested money into financial resources, but correspondingly they had borrowed money from them too. But again, they're part of the people being bought out, and the preferred shareholders, the receivable preferred shareholders, were the people we had to buy out. So and actually,
we have to buy out. You mean in the Bureau of
financial
regulation settlement process?
Right, yeah, right. Okay. Right. Where financial resources were instructed in order to move on, they had to liquidate those positions.
And the current portion of notes receivable, the second one down, 06, 07, 08, is $375,000. That was what you.
So those are two pieces. So in 03, 04, that's Creative Couriers,
right.
Okay? It gets sold in 2005. In 2006, we finally get the NRI judgment from the Supreme Court, which was for $300,000, and we accrued interest of $75,000. So that, when you look at 06, 07, 08, that's still the NRI Supreme Court judgment. And what doesn't show up there, there was also a loan loss reserve that was on the books for $125,000, which so the net of that was $250,000 on the books.
And as I understand that loan loss, was that because out of the $375,000, you determined through a letter with Gould and Burke that it cost $150,000 to collect that debt?
Or thereabouts. I mean, and it wasn't a letter. It was just discussions with the attorneys. How much is this going to cost? How long is it going
to
take?
And then recover the $375,000.
Right.
So then you take off that much of the asset based on the offset, how much it would cost?
Right. Right. I'm thinking what we're eventually going to get.
Sure. And we can go back to these slides as we come across other questions in later slides, but we can move forward for now.
This is the liability section. That's what I guess I was talking to you earlier. I mean, the payables back to, you know, from the normal accounts payables, it wasn't a large item for the firm to, for us to be able to book those. So that, you know, back to is what's complicated, not complicated. Accounts payable are $100,000 a year. It's not a large adjustment to make or to look at. And you can see demand in short-term notes payable. You can see at the beginning of the year, we also owed people. So how this company was funded was at the beginning, they had preferred shareholders and preferred subscribed shareholders. They also had people that advanced monies on notes. So there were some unsecured note holders themselves. So again, you can see that being paid off is back to, we need to get rid of all these people that advanced monies either through securities or and or debt. So that's why that number, and it's higher in 01 and 02 due to the participation loans more than anything else, and that again goes down because of the Bureau's involvement.
And because of the change of the structure of the entity.
Yep, right.
How long did it take to satisfy the requirements of the Bureau subsequent to the negotiations? It looks to me like it took.
So what happens in 01, it's really kind of interesting. 01 is when everything happens and we restate. In 02, 03, and 04, it was kind of nothing happened. So, and again, I'll show you, you'll see the preferred shareholders. And then it's really in 05, beginning of 05, 06, and the first quarter of 07, where everything is, everybody that's involved is bought out. There's just a little bit in 2005. Maybe I'll advance to the next slide here. And this will kind of give you a real snapshot. So 2001, we restate. So that's where you go from having preferred stock from in the preferred stock subscribed, have large changes. But you can see it pretty much stays the same in 02, 03, and 04. And then it's 05 that there's a small amount of preferred stock redeemed, and then it's 06 where the rest of it gets, the majority of it gets redeemed.
And the retained earnings, if you see in 2001, we see a $1.15 or so million deficit in retained earnings. Through our conversations, you indicated to me that at that time in 2001 is when you became aware of shareholders, so you had to
restate.
Because prior to 2001, is it my understanding that you were not aware of any shareholders or loans made to FRM prior to 99?
Well, I had most of the information there. What we were lacking were the preferred shareholders and some of the participation notes. And that naturally, once we put the schedules together, that I was not aware of it. Otherwise, we would have booked it in 2000 and 1999.
So in fact, those were shareholders prior to, but you could only reflect them when you found out about them in 01, and that number would, the shareholder number, in 99 it said preferred stock subscribed zero, and preferred stock 93,000. Based on what you discovered in 01, those numbers would also be higher?
What's 01? 01 should be fairly stated.
How did you become aware that the existed preferred shareholders?
It came from the Bureau, I believe it's from a complaint that started the Bureau investigation, and then Gallagher, Dennis was the one that contacted me and said, we have...
That'd be Dennis Maloney?
Dennis Maloney, yeah. It wasn't voluntary from Scott.
It wasn't Barrett. From Mr. Farrell, was it?
No. No. And part of the difficulty became, he wasn't paying interest. So you got preferred shares that are supposed to be, whether they're subscribed or not subscribed, they had an interest rate they were supposed to be paying, but they were being offset.
Do you have any difficulty continuing to do audits for somebody like FRM when you've discovered that at some point in time the representations to you are less than factual?
It gets back to the individual. And even the relationship, understanding and knowing Scott Farrer, he was a very charismatic type of person, you know, and it's back to you got to have, I guess, be a bad judgment of character. You have to look at the character, and again, if you're going to describe the individual, is when I looked over the years, it was all a matter of him making simple mistakes. That was the way it was prescribed. And again, he was always chasing, aggressively looking for the next sale. He's a foreign sales guy, so the whole part became, my belief is, he just made a mistake. He didn't mean to not disclose those items. And the fact that they were offsetting each other, when, even though you make all these changes, there were individuals that didn't have the interest. I mean, his goal when he originally had the audit was, look, I just need to get this mandatory down. So he looked at the audit as a necessary evil. So back to, did I think he made a mistake? That's what I believe that he had. I mean, he also took the corrective action that's going to make an auditor, when he gets somebody like Dennis Malone and Gallagher involved, obviously he's really trying to fix it. And that's where my judgment goes, okay, we made a mistake. We didn't have audited numbers. This guy doesn't keep accrual books. So it's not, he didn't have the sophistication to be able to book all these transactions within a system, because again, he's just on a cash basis. So at that point in time, I just looked at it as he just made a mistake. And it, you know, having the right people on board, having the right people to try to get this right, I didn't take it as being that he purposely misled me. Otherwise, that would have, I would have sat there and said, I just don't want to do business with my ex. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
And Mr. Connor, I think this might be a good time to, because I want to know why, when you discovered that major change in 01, I want to talk about why that didn't cause you to issue a going concern. So
sure.
I'd like to clarify what a going concern is,
mm-hmm.
and explain that to us.
Right.
And get into why that didn't occur in 01.
Sure. So even though you look at what the definition of technical insolvency is one of the definitions is you have negative retained earnings. In this situation, all we're doing is moving the numbers around. So yes, he's technically insolvent, but when we look at a going concern opinion, we're required to, there's a little program that we fill out to make that determination. One of the issues is this, but the other part is you look at mitigating circumstances. Does the person have positive equity? In this case, situation, he always had positive equity. Is where did the income statement? Is he making money? If he's making, he's profitable. Again, that's another indication that the person's going to continue in business. Back to looking at whether there's, you know, again, the other piece is looking at, does the person have the ability to meet their current obligations or not? So you put all those pieces together, and then based upon, which is kind of interesting, understanding it from an auditor's point of view, a going concern, what we're supposed to evaluate is not whether this company can stay in business for 3 years or 4 years or 6 years after that. We're looking to make the determination of whether that company can survive for one more year. And that one more year is not when we are finishing our audit, it's when the fiscal year ends. So that if I'm at 2001 and I'm doing my audit work and my field work in September or June or whatever that month is in 2002, I'm only looking from July 1 to the end of that year to say, will that business be able to be viable for that period of time? The fact that it goes out of business 13, 14 months, that's not what I'm supposed to be evaluating as a one-year criteria. And the other part is the misnomer about a going concern. A going concern is only two pieces. A going concern is an extra paragraph on the report that says that due to these certain situations of having, usually you're explaining that there's not enough current assets to meet current obligations. You're also explaining that the company's having recurring losses and it's not been able to obtain permanent financing, that there's reasonable doubt that this organization will continue in existence, as explained in a note. So the numbers don't change. The way we value the numbers don't change. The report, let's even some, when we go and concern this, the only difference would have been one little paragraph in the front and a disclosure. The rest of the numbers would have stayed the same.
What are the repercussions of you issuing a going concern? Do you know?
Generally speaking, if there's a lender or whatever, that's just putting on the face of the financial statement the possibility that company won't be able to survive for another year.
Do you think that would cause issues with licensure?
Sure. But in my evaluation each year, the going concern, if you want to talk about that, is the income statement was prior to prior one?
Hit the bottom left button prior.
Bottom left?
See that? Yep.
That one?
Yep. Keep going back until you get to it. You want to go to net income? One more. Right there on the bottom.
So you can see, assuming these numbers are correct, they're making income each year. So the fact that they have income, the fact that their equity is still positive, those were the biggest mitigating factors that would basically, I concluded that these aren't going concern. There's not a going concern issue here.
And I just want to take a quick second to clarify. When you say assuming these numbers are correct, you did in fact verify these with the financial statements, right?
Right.
Okay, so when you say assuming these numbers are correct, that they were reported to you correctly?
Correct. Well, and again, I'll caveat that because we just spent the last 3 days looking at information that I didn't have when I did the audits, and what we're going to show is that there's two sets of documents here. So my documents and what I recorded and what was presented to me based upon these numbers, and I still stand by the audit of what we had for information, there wasn't a going concern.
So it never in 08 to or 99 to 2008, did you ever issue a going concern?
No.
Did you ever come close to issuing a going concern, do you recall?
No. I mean, it's still back to the ability to have income and be able to show that you're still profitable. And if you look at this company, it gets better, except for 2008. You're always making income on it. It's growing in sales. On paper, this looks. If anything, he's digging his way out, doing everything he's supposed to do. So, want me to go forward now?
Please.
All right. Just to kind of explain kind of what I talked about earlier, although my work paper is pretty horrible, back to those major categories, okay? And I'll look down the bottom. We'll work on, if I can get, I'll tell you what these are, okay? This is mortgage income. Again, back to the commissions, for the most part, all the commissions, they would tie right to sales. They would go right to, you go to a HUD statement, and it would be, this is the commission that financial resources earn. So the commissions were composed both, as I said, stated earlier, residential and commercial. And you can see, going back to 2004, there's substantial numbers here, substantial growth here. And the other part I will mention about commissions in 2007, the big difference here, which was kind of going back, financial resources for the most part, the residential mortgages were what I call B and C and D credit. They were the typical loans that people with IndyMac, Countrywide, those were the type of lenders they were using. So what happens in 2007 is part of that business dries up, and that's why you see commissions in 2008 so much lower. Because those lenders aren't available anymore. But the other part you can see is the dramatic increase of 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 of these, of the mortgage income part of it. And this is where he, again, had gotten into the majority of the work being commercial loans that he was brokering. All right, back to the expenses, the other catch-all that I was saying, you can also see the progression here in mortgage expenses. In 2004, 2005, 2006, these are the 2 years in particular that they kind of balloon up. And those were, in 05, the biggest thing here were, again, all these were people primarily that we looked at were, and I've looked at in my audits, were individuals. Back to being circularized, what are we paying you for?
Okay.
But that was the primarily catch-all, and then it goes down to where, and again, I think the correlation here is why he said he had CLM. CLM took all of his servicing, and it was, again, the whole goal was for financial resources just to be the mortgage company. So that's why the mortgage expenses, there weren't a lot of direct, as many direct lenders that we were paying in the latter years through financial resources. Professional fees are very large. These 2 years, these 2 to 3 years here, there's a large settlement here, and there's a huge amount of money that was spent on going after NIR and trying to collect that. But there's a couple of lawsuits that were settled in here. The Ronnie Stone, I think, was $250,000, $300,000, something like that. There's a couple of lawsuits that were settled in here.
Those lawsuit settlements are reflected in professional expenses?
Yeah. Along with the legal fees, yep.
And your fees?
Yep. And again, part of the professional fees, too, or part of the closing costs. Sullivan is in there for all the, you know, that's part of that, too.
All the money paid to Gould & Berg for closing?
Yep.
Would be reflected in there?
Yep. And here is just the kind of, it shows you, too, this is the interest expenses down here where back in 2004, all the servicing, for the most part, is taking place on financial resources. And by the time we're to the end, almost all of this, and you can see the servicing is only $40,000 of that This was a couple of amounts he paid to private lenders, from which I confirmed not being an obligation. But this was just the amount of servicing that was taking place.
So he was doing some servicing?
Very small, yeah.
So it goes from 04 to $630,000 worth of servicing down to $40,000?
It's correct. And again, here, just so that this piece here is something we're going to talk about very soon, is this particular year, 2005, you can see that the mortgage income bumped from, I wish I could read it, but to $5.9 million. Out of that, there's a sale of two mortgages by two CLM totaling $4.8 million. Okay.
That's FRM selling to CLM two mortgages that they held.
Right.
And we'll get into detail about those mortgages in a minute.
All right, this is just kind of what we've chatted about. These were all the individuals that were on the preferred shareholders or in preferred share, or the stock preferred share subscribed. One of them's subscribed, and this one's that. That's just showing the years that, and chronologically how they got bought out. But as I spoke earlier, by the time we get to first quarter 2007, we've redeemed everybody out.
And this is 04, 05, 06. Right. The next slide, but.
Right, which again shows the finalizing of, if you could read this, finalizing of the preferred stock being these people being bought out.
So that's just your work paper showing the first quarter of 2007.
And all these check marks mean we confirmed that we got paperwork, that the checks went out, and then the cancellation of the securities that were being held, that type of thing.
So everybody on that preferred shareholder was fully satisfied by 2007, and yet the character of the business had changed at about 2001.
Well, it didn't so much change. The big change, I really think, comes about when CLM comes on board to enable Scott to be able to concentrate on making the bucks on these large private loans.
The brokerage.
Right. And CLM now is coming on board to do all the servicing so that Financial Resources can just concentrate on marketing and packaging these private mortgage deals.
Give me a frame of reference for that. And as you say, CLM came on board.
Well, these two deals happened in May and in May, June of 2005. And then from that point on, from 05 and 06, in that they were supposed to be doing all the servicing for whatever else was going on. So he had issues in dealing, and that's what I'd always come back, why we had to confirm all these people. I mean, naturally, he'd rather not have to send out confirmations, but having to send out 15 confirmations to these people that they're private lenders, then it became, that's part of the nature of the beast. You have so many things going through. So it became, his resolve was, hey, I got CLM's going to be doing all my servicing. I'm getting rid of all my assets to comply with the Bureau. Now it's going to be a brokerage. But if you look to the professional fees, which might be included in that, I believe, if I went back and looked, he spent an enormous amount of money on IT to develop his website and the marketing. And that happened to coincidentally with that 2005 area. So
potentially that could also be reflected in his office expenses?
His American Express card was his office expense, so pretty much whatever went through American Express
other
went to office.
Other than the phone bill, did you ever look at the detail of what was being spent?
At American Express?
Yeah.
Yep.
So what is generally, do you remember that being typical office expenses or personal expenses?
There was a bunch of personal expenses each year that I had to kind of pull out and put to his compensation account.
So you would go through what he bought on his American Express and allocate whether it was a business expense or personal, to separate.
And we would chat about what is this for? Is this business or not business? Because there were certain charges that he had going through there.
So whatever you determined was not part of the business expense, you would allocate as
officer's
compensation.
Yeah. This is a confirmation letter that I received from Dennis Maloney. This was at the end. What is that, dated August?
This is what you sent to Dennis Maloney.
I call it a confirmation. It was confirmation for me to Dennis confirming that we have, this is all this stuff all these. These were Arches, Boston Hill, the bar, and NIR were all participation loans, and that they were all paid off in full. The infamous. This is the CLM, the first one, right?
Sure. And since this is a document that you were unaware of, I'll talk to it.
Okay.
Again. This is a document that was in your possession. It's the next document you're unaware of.
Right.
You gave me this document.
Yes, I did. I'll tell you. So back to the 2005. There's two things that occurred in 2005. He sells. This is a Creative Courier now, which is a purchase sale. This was the. And it comes from my work papers. So he gave me this purchase and sale agreement that he sold his note for $730,000. Here's the purchase and sale payment record that's also confirmed and signed by, paid in full by Donald E. Dodge on 7/5/2005, that CLM bought this and paid for a mortgage.
So let me just interject there.
So that $730,000 in my audited financial statements is reflected as income, mortgage income in that year, based upon these sales documents and the confirmation from Donald Dodge at CLM that it was a sale of a mortgage.
So FRM previously held receivable of $730,000 Creative Couriers, and they sold that on, what was the date on that one? Because the dates are important for this, too. If you go back one second, this is the second one. Go back one. One more. Okay, so on June 6, 2005, CLNM purchases for $730,000 the money that was due.
The courier rights along with the first mortgage. Yeah, there's two pieces.
Do you have any indication of what they paid for this in the first?
Yeah, that was back on the early slides. That was being carried on the books for $300,000.
So it was being carried on as receivable for $300,000, and it was sold to CLNM for $730,000?
Yep.
Did that trigger any red flags?
It's an unrelated party.
What's
so,
that mean?
Unrelated party, and it gets back to, you know, what CLM. So an unrelated party, for when we do part of our audit, we have to do inquiries to discover who's a related party, who's not a related party. Related party is an entity that is either owned by the same individual or owned by that same individual by blood, a brother or a sister or a wife or whatever. And CLM was a completely separate entity owned by Donald Dodge. So even though we have a transaction here, it's no different than the fact, I guess, what's been inferred, he's in the same building. Well, even from ethics interpretation, person being in the same building does not create an independence issue or whatever. So the fact that a company is there, just like Gould and Burke, doesn't make them a related party just because they're renting space from them. So related party is defined by ownership primarily. There is some requirements that are now out where you would have to potentially consolidate other entities that have dependencies upon it. But it would also have to be a debt that would, where, you know, if financial resources had lent money for this company to be in existence, or had startup fees, or had some other direct contractual arrangement between them, there was an obligation back to it, then you could say that there was an economic dependency, and potentially there's a rule on the variable interest entities where you would have to consolidate that. But if it's
so when you see something like this, do you look at the corporate filing documents for CLNM? I noticed that, if my eyes don't fail me, that's a Nevada corporation.
Right, I do absolutely nothing except for it's a sale, make sure it's recorded properly, and the party here was on an installment basis, make sure that asset's collectible. So my primary emphasis, just like any other transaction, if it's not made to a related party, I'm not going to be looking to sit there and go.
And that standard is established by?
That's generally accepted auditing or accounting principles,
okay.
Yes. Yep. Right.
And that's a defined standard that we'd see if we went to some particular source that you would give us.
Right, right, right.
So they sell it for $730. These are the three payments that were made by CLNM to FRM to pay off in full on July 5th, very soon after the transaction, a month later. They paid it off in full.
Right, and this is purchase and sale document, and that's the other part that's signed off by Don Dodge. This is not... That's their document that they created for the sale. So,
and if you make note, Mr. Chandler, of those three dates that those transactions happened and the amount. It'll make your understanding of some future slides even better. 618.05, it was 200,000.
Whoops, do you want me to go back?
One second. It'll help you see what we're going to reveal in a little bit. 200,000 was on 618.05.
Okay.
On 7205, another 200,000. And on 7505, 330,000. That totals 730,000. Yep. So please continue.
So here's the second purchase and sale that occurs in July, right?
Which is right after the payoff of those three transactions we talked about. Now on July 16th, a week after that third $330,000 transaction, another purchase and sale agreement. And please explain what it is.
Right. He sold his assigned. Okay. So Gary Coyne in Financial Resources owned. What did they own? They owned.
It says. To reflect your memory, you can go to the two slides from now, and you'll see the assignment by Gary Coyne.
It's an assignment of a. And it's not a foreclosure, it's an assignment of
a lien,
right? So it's
I believe Gary Coyne had a lien on Boston Hill, and he sold his lien rights on Boston Hill to FRM, and on the same day, FRM sells it to CLNM for $4.5 million, which creates another receivable on FRM books of $4 million, which looks like an asset coming in at this point.
Right, it's booked as a sales transaction, the same thing as we've confirmed over the number of years with Gary Coyne, and or one of his other GCX Financial or another one of his companies. Yeah. Again, one of these individuals, we confirmed with them whether we're obligated, not obligated, unrelated parties. So the way I look at this is it a sale, not a sale, and it's booked as a sale. And again, similar to the other transaction, here is the document of purchase and sale payment record that was provided to me, showing all the dates, all the amounts, and this is a sale.
So this is all the payments over 2005 all the way up to 629.06?
Right. And that line item there is just the break between the years. So where that line comes in on my work paper, what's the total up at the end of 05, what was still due as a receivable at that point in time.
So according to your records, when you were around in this time period, this $4.1 million note was paid in full by 629.06?
Yep.
And reflected on the books that way?
It would have been reflected in the year of sale. So both those transactions, the $4,830,000 would be recorded as mortgage income in 2005.
And that's why we saw the spike that we saw.
Yep.
If you go one more slide next, it'll be, this is what you also have in your records as the assignment of attached lien.
Yep.
Which was, this purports to be what?
Well, this is basically clearing Financial Resources to sell it, the whole interest, because before it had been an interest that both Financial Resources and Gary Coyne had.
So Financial Resources has an interest in Boston Hill. Gary Coyne also has an interest in Boston Hill. Is this document now transferring Gary Coyne's interest to Financial Resources?
Right.
And the date of it is July 10th, 2005.
Same day. Yep.
You can go back and just want to, and the date of the purchase and sale to CLNM, was that July 16th? Go back one more. It appears to be the 10th, actually. I'm sorry. So it was, in fact, the same day that Gary Coyne's interest is transferred to Financial Resources. On that very same day, it was transferred to CLNM for an income of $4.1 million on
foreign
books.
But keep in mind, this just didn't happen that day. This is something Financial Resources, along with Gary Coyne, had. They had this interest going back for a couple of years, and that's where prior when we were looking at receivables, this was on the books as one of those receivables. So this had been around a couple of years.
What was it booked at?
Good question. Maybe I have notes.
Mr. Chandler, since he's looking for some necessary paperwork, can we take a 5-minute recess at our request?
Absolutely. Go off the record, 5-minute recess.
No.
OK. Okay, we're back on the record. This is Mr. Chandler again. Before we took a 5-minute break at the request of the Bureau, I posed a question to Mr. Connor if he could review his records to see if he had any understanding of what the $4,100,000 note was booked for.
Yeah, our percentage of that, looking back at my notes, is showing that we had a 12% interest in $12 million attachment. So, approximately $1.2 million is what the value would have been.
So the book value would have been $1.2 million. Okay. Having answered that question, we're going to proceed through a few more slides of Mr. Connor before we break for lunch. We're going to break for lunch, and then we're going to return and go on it. In a different tack, if you will. Proceed,
correct,
Mr. Connor.
This slide here is a confirmation that I received when I was doing field work at the time. It just happened that I was at field work and Don Dodge was available, so I wasn't able this particular year to type up a formal confirmation. But again, I wanted to make sure for my audit to have him confirming that there wasn't any outstanding obligation, that there wasn't any guarantees. And we have these confirmations for the 06 year, the 07 year, the 08 year, where he's confirming there are no obligations, there are no liabilities, there's no contingent or direct liability between Financial Resources and CLM. So, and again, if I go to the next slide, I believe this is the one for the with Don Dodge here, where he signs it again. There's none, and
Again, explain to me what that representation is that's being made in that.
Back to an audit. Whenever you're doing an audit, the highest level of evidence that you can get is an outside verification of what it is. So what I'm doing here is I'm looking at, there's monies that are coming in from back to mortgage income. There's monies coming in from CLM. What is it? Okay. So what's the best way to find that out, confirm what the source? Well, what is it? Is it an obligation or is it recorded properly as revenue? Because otherwise I can change the whole financial statement. Somebody gives us $2 million and it ends up not being revenue, it becomes a liability, and all of a sudden, instead of making $2 million, you lost $2 million and the equity section is therefore reduced. But in here is, again, it's back to finding out, is it any kind of liability? Because what had been sometimes done in the past where, and again, whenever you sell something, there may be contingencies. There may be, when you have a loan, sure, the loan is the underlying collateral, but that's why we send them out to...
So what did that letter tell you?
Well, that letter tells me that Financial Resources is not obligated in any way to repay any advances that have been made during the year ended December. There is no outstanding amounts due you from Financial Resources as of December 31, 2007. Financial Resources National is not guaranteed of providing additional collateral or security for transactions that have occurred, and the company is not contingently liable in any way as of December 31st. Financial Resources has not issued or promised to issue stock in the company and is not conditionally obligated to issue notes payable or share of stock. So in my mind, this is about as unequivocally as you can get from a third party that this is not a liability in any shape or form, so that in my mind, I'm okay to leave whatever advances CLM has had as the company is representing to me as being revenue. And again, we're going to find he signs a similar note in each of the years. Whoops, I'll go back. How do I go back? This is where we're going to put it.
Right,
that's his document. So that's the last document. And that's not, CLM wasn't any different. There would be another 8 or 9 people that I would be sending similar confirmations. So the language there wasn't really any different than the other confirmations.
So that language wasn't aimed at CNN. That's ordinary course of events.
So that would be going out to to direct lenders. So that would be going out to these people that had also advanced funds along with CLM, you know, to the same generic letter just for them to come back and tell me, and they always come back clear.
I understand.
So I'm from my information, the rest of the presentation is all information we obtain.
Okay. At this
afterwards.
What time is it, Michelle?
I think it's 12:25.
We're going to adjourn and we're going to reconvene at 1:25.
Should I talk to security about
125, we're back on the record. Mr. Spiller, Mr. Forsey, do we have any preliminary matters?
I just remembered I need to load up an additional updated PowerPoint so I could get two more minutes. I forgot I got to
do
that.
Got it.
Mr. Connor, if I may sit there for a moment.
We're on. Okay. It's approximately 1:25, December 10th. This is the afternoon session of the FRM hearings, as called by the New Hampshire Secretary of State. I am Charles Chandler, the hearings, the presiding officer. And we have as a witness Mr. Connor. Mr. Connor, you were sworn this morning. That sworn testimony continues this afternoon. And I believe when we left, we closed at what we considered to be a logical point for you from which to proceed into a second component of your testimony. Is that correct?
That's correct. We ended with the audit findings as I had gone through when I did my work, and now we're getting into the subsequent work that's taken place with the Bureau here on what other documents they had that we worked together to kind of piece some information together from my work papers.
Please proceed.
I got to go back on the slides, right?
Sure. In sum, before we broke for lunch, we saw a note that was between CLNM and FRM. This note right here is for $4.1 million, and that was sold to CLNM by FRM on July 10th of 2005. The slides prior to this, we saw a $730,000 note that was also sold from FRM to CLNM. The total is just shy of $5 million. Correct, right?
And that $4,100,000 note is the note that we determined had a booked value of $1,000,001. Is that correct?
$1,002,000. Mr. Connor looked back at his notes and determined that the book value of that asset was $1.2 million.
Okay.
And we can just keep it right here for a moment.
Okay.
So this is the second note for $4.1 million, and it was right after CLNM had finished paying off the first note of $730,000 to FRM. Immediately thereafter, this note appears in Mr. Connor's work papers as a $4.1 million sale to CLNM. And if you go to the next slide, this is the payment schedule on that $4.1 million note. This indicates that it was paid off in full by 6/29/06. As Mr. Connor testified earlier, those payments were reflected in the 2005 financial statements.
Correct.
Even though payment was completed in 6/29/06, all these payments are reflected in his financial statements in 2005.
What's the source of this? What is this document? Where did it come from?
This was amongst Mr. Connor's work papers. And what is the document? Or this right here is the schedule of payments that accompanied the purchase and sale agreement, all of which were contained in Mr. Connor's work papers.
So when I did the audit to obtain evidence what this is what was issued by the client.
Okay, that's what I needed to know.
Right.
Thank you.
Okay. And if you click to the next slide, there was an assignment there that was incorporated with it. The assignment went to FRM, and FRM accompanied that assignment, that portion. They also had some portion themselves, meaning they purchased the assignment and added that to the portion of Boston Hill that they had already acquired. So they combined those two and sold it to CLNM on July 10th, 05. So if you go to the next slide.
That's just a confirmation.
We have, go to the next three slides as you go here. These are all confirmations by Dodge that Mr. Connors sent to him, which would indicate that Mr. Dodge of CLNM did verify that those payments that he saw coming in were, in fact, payments on that note rather than any liability or anything else.
So I confirmed
that there's no liabilities with CLNM. This is a discretionary line of credit dated, it's hard to read, but it's dated, I believe, 6/05. But I know for sure it's 2005. I would be almost certain it's 6/05, which is obviously around the same time that we saw those other purchase and sale agreements. This is a $10 million line of credit that CLNM purportedly gave to FRM. So obviously, my question to mind when I saw this document and I was meeting with Mr. Connor was, A, were you aware of this document? B, if any money was drawn on this $10 million line of credit, then that should be reflected in his books. So we started off with this document, and Mr. Connors, if you could answer again, have you ever seen this document prior to our meetings last week?
No, I have not.
Okay, so we see what indicates to me as a promissory, as a discretionary line of credit. So FRM, Scott Farah, had the ability to call CLNM, call Donald Dodge, and borrow money.
Yeah, and the only thing I want to point out in the document while I'm looking at it right now, and you blanked out address of, I assume that's a street address in Meredith, right?
This was drawn from the Attorney General's website. I assume that was his personal address, but
right.
I cannot guarantee that.
And the only reason I'm bringing this up, it appears to me that it's a note between CLM and Scott Farah.
So it's not FRM on this particular note. It's the next one where we see that. Okay, so this one is Scott personally borrowing from CLM. Our line of credit of $10 million. Now, my question to you, Mr. Carter, now that you raised that, would that be something that Mr. Farah would have to disclose to you? Nonetheless, even though it's not under FRM, it's under him personally. Would that be something that you would go into?
No. So assuming the borrowings are taking place completely between those two people and two parties, now looking at this, too, does that give a way for Don Dodge to sit there and confirm? No. Financial Resources doesn't owe me any money,
okay.
Or my CLM, because Scott Farah owns money. And I wouldn't be confirming with Scott that he would owe any money to CLM because it's a transaction outside of, you know, of FRM.
Okay, fair enough. So if you go to the next document, so this one's dated 05, but what I can infer is over the period of time between 05 and 09, this amount got larger and larger and larger. And by the close of FRM, if you go to the next slide, please, this is called a note series between Scott Farah, which we're assuming again is individually, and CLNM. Now, this amount has been written in as $20,000,348 or so dollars, and that's dated 11/5/2009. So it's as if this note was updated in the last week that FRM existed. So what it is, this next slide is the first page of like five, that is the payment schedule of Scott Farah drawing on that line of credit, and it's being added up over time, and these dates vary all the way up to 09, and it totals over those four years, it totals over $20 million that Dodge has reported in his books as loaning personally to Scott Farah.
Let's back up to the
sure.
$20 million.
It's totaled right there, and it's totaled in the beginning as well. Now, when I had this document in front of me, and having spoken with Mr. Connor, I wondered to myself if those Boston Hill payments coincided with what these payments were. And that's, in fact, what we discovered, is that those Boston Hill payments were recorded as a liability on CLNM books to Scott Farah individually. And I'll explain how we made that connection. You would see, and please correct me if I'm wrong, we have the Boston Hill dates and transaction amounts, and he would confirm in his notes of FRM's transactions that FRM received, let's say on one of the days, 6/1/05, $300,000 was paid out of CLNM for that Boston Hill note. On his records, he saw the same amount of money coming in within a day of that into FRM books. So we didn't have necessarily confirmation numbers to verify, but the numbers were more than coincidence in coinciding with the numbers on the Boston Hill project, meaning they're sort of double counted. Although Scott was borrowing it individually, according to this note, it was being brought into Financial Resources as payment for the Boston Hill note. So in essence, what is your...
Well, what you have here is a schedule of all the wires that were done. I'm assuming if you went and looked at the bank statements on CLM, these are a schedule of all the wires that went from CLM to various sources. Or to Scott.
Okay.
And on my side of the books, what I have is that schedule of payments for that sale of those two notes to dictate what date those wires were and the amounts that were paid by CLNM to FRM, which tie right out to their bank statements, tie right out to their, you know, detail of where, you know, wire amounts and into their general ledger. Coincidentally, this schedule of debt that ties to this note is the same exact amounts that are listed in as my sale amounts being recorded on Financial Resources. We can match them dollar for dollar coming from CLM. So we didn't verify by looking at
underlying data that, you know, that there was a wire that went from one bank to the other, but it just coincidence. The exact day, the same amount, the same sale amount happens to be one of these disbursements is from this note to Scott coming directly from CLM to Financial Resources.
In other words, your opinion, Mr. Connor, that these were in fact liabilities and money owed back by either Financial Resources or Farah individually?
They're telling me the story that I need to hear to record it as favorably on Financial Resources, which it's a sale of these properties. On CLM books, for whatever reason, they're calling it a note receivable, or they're advancing notes or advancing amounts to Scott Farah as a loan.
So if you took away the purchase and sale agreements on those two and just had these documents, it would be a straight loan to Scott Farah.
And again, it would have. Again, let's assume the amounts come back. Let's assume the documents are there, and I have a wires coming from Scott Farah. And if he represents to me on those wires that this is all income I'm paying for my personal accounts for services rendered, the fact that I have all this infrastructure here, Financial Resources. And if he drew up, he could draw up all the dummy documents he wanted to, if he wanted for management services, and made that money. It would still be revenue over on the side if I couldn't confirm that it was a debt owing to somebody else. If that makes any sense.
I do understand what you're saying. I don't know, Mr. Chandler.
But I was going to lose you. But
yes, you did.
Okay.
So I'll tell you my major concern is, and I listened to you earlier, but we have Scott Farah in his individual capacity here.
Right.
So. And it seemed to me you made a substantial distinction earlier in the morning about individual capacity and corporate capacity. And if I'm having trouble tying the two, having listened to you this morning. So
over on finances, we'll step back to the documentation that was given to me as part of the audit on FRM.
Okay.
So we have two sales of notes, two large notes, the CLM, that are written up, and all the documentation looks great, that their sales to CLM for FRM that says here's the schedule of payments that FRM is going to receive and CLM has made to FRM for this sale. Coincidentally, when this document shows up, those same wire amounts that are from earlier this morning that shows all these different dates back on, okay? These amounts all here on this purchase, this sale agreement, match up to, you could find them on that whole schedule that's over on this new document that was shown to me from this line of credit.
When did you become aware of this, as you call it, the new document?
When I met with Eric this week.
This week.
So up in that point in time, all I had was this document saying we sold these two notes. So that's what we just said is, and that was what we were posing. Well, let's look and see if we can find these. These are going to be part of this quasi line of credit that's been talked about. Sure enough, these amounts we tied out each one of these to being in that schedule on that note. So out of the $4.83 million ties out to his schedule from this. Whoops.
So obviously, on Dodge's end, from CLM's point of view, these payments, they're considered owed back to them. They consider them loans.
Right.
So whether it's a note back from Scott or it's a note back from FRM, it sure is either. What is it? It's not. He's given a sale document, so in theory, it shouldn't be a note back from either
is it
party.
What is it? The big question for you, though. I mean, had you had some awareness of that second note?
If he didn't come up and give me these documents to say this is a sale, that presents a whole different set of problems. But this is just perfect. It's a sale. Here's the sale. Here's the amounts. It's, you know, you record it as a sale transaction, and Dodge can come and, you know, confirms that there's no liability there.
So, and then obviously these schedules.
And then he's got a separate set of books going on, if you want to call it that, that he's recording out, you know, the note on the side that just ends up.
He, you mean?
Don Dodge.
Don Dodge.
It's almost as if Don Dodge wouldn't have purchased it for $4 million unless he was getting the money back. It's almost as if, because he didn't consider it to be worth that much, if he recorded it as money loaned to Scott Farah. And it's loaned to him individually, which is another way they most likely did this, or I'm assuming they did, to skirt his...
If the loan becomes a personal rather than a corporate loan, you're not going to intrude into that area employing the standards that you need to utilize as an auditor. Is that correct?
Unless, again, CLM or financial resources was contingently, you know what I mean? You can come back and have note. Let's assume this is a legitimate note back, and he confirms that there's no note, and the money is still sitting there. Unless financial resources is a contingent person on the note, is securing the note, is guaranteeing the note, then it becomes no different if Scott had borrowed the money on his house or borrowed the money personally and then turned around and said, look, I'm either giving it to my company or it's revenue for charges from my company to myself for all the expenses that I incur by having the FRM as providing the services I need to carry out my business. So the long and the short of what I just said is if this is still a note to Scott and there are no other agreements for FRM to back up that note, then the financial statements reflecting this note wouldn't change.
And that was my next question. Since it's individually, then it's not going to change everything we just went over anyway. It's just going to make him individually liable for about $5 million.
Or $10 million or $20
million.
Or
$20 by the time I got to the end, correct. So we were just... stumbled upon that, and we're pretty interested to see that it lined up perfectly. So obviously, on CLNM's books, they consider that to be worth $4 million, and they documented every dollar out as a liability.
And then it becomes what's the real. So there is a fraud that's occurred here. Is you're providing the auditor with either a phony document, and it's a loan from CLM to Scott Ferrer, or when you connect the dots, the reality becomes these are direct wires from CLM to financial resources. They matched up day for day. And again, I haven't gone and looked at the documentation to check where the wire went from, the wire directly went from CLM into FRM. But I would suppose that if you're, why is it that if it's really only loan to Scott, why are the funds going directly from CLM over into FRM?
So what do you do now as a CPA who's performed the audit of FRM?
Right now?
What do you have to do anything because of professional standards that...
To reissue or to correct this? Or
yes.
Or to, besides, and call my errors and omissions? Notify my insurance carrier that there's you know, this issue? It gets back to even another question you can raise. Well, let's assume I find this fraud and it's a fraud, which is a really kind of interesting question. What am I required to do?
That's really what I'm asking.
If this had occurred, what I should be doing is resigning the job, and then I would notify the board of directors of the fraud that I found, and I'm supposed to contact my insurance company or whatever I encountered, and that's all I believe the legal ethical obligation I have to do.
We're sitting here with a regulated entity. There isn't any doubt, because of the issuance of licenses from the New Hampshire Banking Commission, that they're a regulated entity. Do you have any professional obligation to advise the New Hampshire Banking Commission of your perceptions at this point in time? They're more than perceptions. But
yeah, now that I connected, I'm not sure. I've got to probably call my attorney and find out, do I need to notify anybody? But this just, we connected the dots this week. So
the only way we're incorrect is if these wires going out that match up perfectly in his books are just mere coincidence. Every one of these, this exact number, happen to come into FRM at the same time by wire. So the likelihood of that being the case is very, very unlikely. So I feel pretty strongly that this double counting that we're showing you today is in fact what happened.
So right. Between this sheet and the other one?
Yeah, these numbers all you would find by the day. Well,
and another thing, it goes beyond, obviously that note, this schedule of payments of the $22 million go beyond the satisfaction of those two purchase and sale agreements. If you look past 06, and we verified 06, 07, and 08, those are not no longer payments under the purchase and sale agreement, but rather they're just wires that we see are recorded going out of CNM and coming into FRM. Not every single one of those. It's almost as if, at Farah's direction, Dodge would either send it to Financial Resources, because we were able to verify another few million dollars of the remaining money was on the same day coming into Financial Resources. Other numbers, for example, that $1 million on A407, that doesn't come into Financial Resources. We checked his book. So it's almost as if Scott Farah directed CNM to send $1 million in this instance to somewhere. And we haven't been able to determine where, but we know it didn't come into FRM.
Right.
Do you understand what I'm saying?
I fully understand.
All the purchase and sale agreements will show up on the schedule. And then beyond that, for the next 2.5 years, only some come into books and others go to maybe project managers. Who knows? Maybe personal accounts. We don't know.
And that's what we'll be able to connect around, what, $7 million,
including $5 million. So another $2.5 million over the next 2.5 years, we were able to confirm. And we didn't. We confirmed that, but I'm assuming there's probably a little bit more than that that came into FRM. But we quickly confirmed same day transactions in both books for another $2.5 million on top of the $5 million. So $7.5 million was wired to, of that 22 was wired to.
What was the date on the 20 million plus?
That was
5 days before they closed, 11/5/09. Four days. That was if you updated it in the last week.
The only reason why I brought you back here, which makes sense to, I mean, if it was $20 million that came in as mortgage income, obviously, we don't have that coming in, and that it's impossible. And then if you take out on and 205 out of that is 4.8 mil. So there's only another $1 million to $2 million a year. That, and even that, by looking at when I look through it, it's not all coming from there. So it makes sense that there's probably about 8 million or so that he had wired directly in, and where the other 12, you know, who knows. But because we were able to go through.
Yeah, we were able to confirm 7.5 to 8 of that was right to from CLM to FRM. Now, we don't have the confirmation numbers of bank to bank. We're just making that leap of faith because the numbers come in and go out the same day, within a day of each other, and the number is exactly the same. 57,000 came out, 57,000 went in. Never did we aggregate totals to come up with numbers. These are only directs.
So of the 20, you've tracked about 8. What you're telling me.
Yep.
So we've got 12.
They could have went to other companies, other trusted. I mean, there was other individuals that were associated with Scott Farah that were doing projects. Maybe they were sent to them. I'm just trying to come up with guesses here. I'm not sure.
But we don't know.
We don't know.
We don't know.
Exactly. We don't know.
You don't know. The only thing that you do know about it is that there's 8 million roughly. That made it to FRM, and then there's 12 million that is elsewhere.
And of that 8 million, 5 million was double counted as both a purchase and sale agreement and a liability to sale that books.
Okay, I understand.
Right, which I don't know, we still have the last slide. What Eric was posing is, supposedly you take out the 5 million, even just the 5 million.
There is a last slide to go there, yeah.
And what is it? Is this the last one?
Yeah. The only difference is the borrowed from, supposed to say CLNM, but it got cut off. Borrowed from CLNM. I'm putting this as if it came to, as if it all came to FRM. All 20s accounted there. I just wanted to say, how does that affect the balance sheet? But we just discovered today that it went to Scott personally, so it doesn't affect the balance sheet. So he still wouldn't have seen it, even if this was accounted.
But then you raise the question: if it's really Scott's money, does the money then get all recorded as income or not? If you know it's being advanced to CLNM to him personally as a loan.
Right.
So one way or another. Whether we knew there was advances to Scott, it probably would have came out of the, it wouldn't have been reflected as, if I knew that it was being recorded as a note on CLM, it's not going to be revenue on the side of Financial Resources.
So again, we can take off the $5 million that was supposed to be revenue. And how does that $5 million
but even
change the balance?
Right. I mean, because that all happened in 2005, and all of a sudden, if you take roughly the 4.8, you take $5 million out. So instead of net income of $385,000, he lost $4.7 million.
And how does that change the balance?
Then, instead of having stockholders' equity of $1 million, he has a deficit of $4 million or thereabouts.
So it completely flips the balance, and he's insolvent. And
absolutely, he's not just technically insolvent. He gets the going concern opinion, and again, if he's drawing down on a loan agreement to fund the company, he would continue to be going concern, because he would have lost if you, I don't know, maybe there's another couple million each year.
Right.
Obviously, he would have had a loss in 06, he would have had a loss in 07, he would have had a loss in 08.
But it got worse and worse and worse. Over.
So if you had that information in, and indicated and created a going concern letter to him, do you then share that with any regulators?
Yeah. I mean, that audited report was a requirement of the banking.
Okay.
And banking would have gotten that, and obviously they would have had problems with that.
Okay.
So the last thing Financial Resources wants in their books is that transaction, those numbers. So the whole purpose of setting this up this way was to avoid the going concern that would have been put into their statements. So the way Mr. Connors described to me was, this is the perfect way of the shell company. That's how they do it. They keep their books clean. They do it all off of it in this kind of a way. So the whole purpose of putting it personally, the whole purpose of all that was to avoid Mr. Connor noticing it.
The big thing was calling it a sale and not a loan. That was the whole way you get this. It's a win-win when he's trying to improve his financial statement. So how
about that? I find that interesting because you described him early on, at least in the accounting processes and the manner in which he conducted business, not being really all that sophisticated, and yet this seems relatively sophisticated if he's going to structure this as a sale and not as a loan to avoid an ability of getting a concern letter. That's a pretty high degree of sophistication, wouldn't you think?
No, I think it's a pretty, it's back to understanding what he needs. So back to FHA, whether when he approached me from the beginning, he knew he needed to have $200,000 show up as working capital or as equity. So he knew that requirement. Yeah, and whether he's avoiding a going concern, I don't even think he cares about the going concern. Okay. You know what I mean? He wouldn't have known what a going concern opinion was. He just knew what he needed to show, that he had income, that he was making money, and that was the way he was going to get what he needed to get. So, I mean, he had a simplistic accounting system. It's back to, he did have cash receipts all came in, and if you could prove every year, take the beginning checkbook balance, add the receipts, minus disbursements, tied out to the checkbook balance at the end of the year. So the stuff that went through, I believe it's all recorded. So he wasn't sophisticated in understanding what liabilities and accruing liabilities, how do I make those more complicated gap transactions, but he knew what he was recording and what was going through the books.
Okay.
And he also knew that recording it, this is a liability, would hurt him from a financial point of view than calling it a sale. But that,
you know. Mr. Forcier or Mr. Spill, do you have anything additional of Mr. Connor?
Yes, I do. Thank you.
Mr. Spill.
Thank you, Mr. Connor. Do you know what a Ponzi scheme is?
Sort of. If you want to define it for me, that'd be great.
Individuals putting money into the business, that money is used to pay off older individuals in time who had put money into the business.
Right. So it's a commingling scheme where you take new money, or it could be a commingling, but not a commingling necessarily. But, yeah.
Up until 2005, individuals who had been given unsecured notes was during that time frame that the Bureau got involved in 2001 to 2005, was there an income stream utilized to redeem those notes?
Yes.
Does that show up in the revenue of the company?
It does. I mean, and again, it's further confirmed through the confirmations. I mean, it's back to when you have the monies coming in, obviously, if he's taking other people's monies, what other two sources of revenue does he have? He has commissions for commercial, commissions for residential, which we always tested, it came back fine. The part of where you would be taking somebody else's money would be these advances from folks that would come in for a private mortgage. And they were all confirming that these are private mortgages. So. And they were also confirming on the back end of that, they were all saying there are no liabilities here. So in my mind, he had both private mortgage money plus the commission's money that was going to pay his expenses.
Would you say that the mortgage income and commission income was substantial?
Yes, it was.
Okay. Would you say that was legitimate income?
As far as I tested, yes. Aside from the CLM transaction of that occurred in 2005 of the $4.8 million. Even at that time, it looked like it was legit.
Okay. So if the, up until 2005, if the new money coming in was legitimate and used to pay the old money coming in, is that a Ponzi scheme?
No, it's legit money. It's money he's earned. So he's, if he's paying off, that's not if it's money coming in that's his money that he's earned and it's not due to somebody else or taking somebody else's money, it's income that he's paying to pay off whoever he needs to pay, whatever bills he needs to pay.
And conversely, if the money coming in, new money coming in, is illegitimate, used to pay off the old money coming in, is that a Ponzi scheme?
Yeah, that would be a Ponzi scheme.
Okay. Would you describe the company post-2005 as a Ponzi scheme?
No.
Why?
Well, and again, it gets back to, was the CLM, when we're running this through, let's assume CLM was legitimately, they sold those mortgages, okay, and the money that he's selling on FRM is legitimate sales and not just taking other people's funds. Because in my mind, if CLM money is real, if it's income that's being paid over to financial resources, then the sources, assuming that's legit when I did my audit, it wouldn't be a Ponzi scheme.
If the money from CLNM over to Scott Farah was unauthorized payments or notes of money, would that be a Ponzi scheme?
I'm not sure if it's a Ponzi scheme, but it's fraud or it's money laundering, I guess. So I guess in my mind, what I'm confused about is I think the Ponzi scheme took place all over in CLNM because they're receiving the proceeds from the sale of a private mortgage, and then they take the proceeds and decide, what am I going to do with that? So I'm making that decision on stealing the money, if you want to call it, and then loaning it back to the Scott Farah, who's then either paying the money over or it's considered income over. To me, it's like a laundry thing. So, and maybe I'm just semantics and I'm not the lawyer to understand that that's really a Ponzi scheme on FRM.
But you would agree that that money, if unauthorized, would be illegitimate money to
correct.
Scott Farah.
That's correct.
You stated earlier in your testimony that Scott Farah and Financial Resources wanted to, quote, go national.
Yeah, basically he had gone and spent a lot of money on infrastructure so that he could, through the internet, be able to do these packages and sell these commercial loan packages.
Do you recall any discussion with Dennis Maloney with respect to whether that advertisement or that solicitation would be a security or not?
No, didn't have that conversation at all with Dennis, no.
Did Financial Resources change its name to Financial Resources National?
Changed its name, I think, like three times, but and the last one was right at the end of the year, and we got back to how to label it on the financial statement. So, yeah, I believe it did. And that was with filings again with its the design of that again was to be able to go national and be able to package and market these loans on a national basis.
Did you know whether CLNM had formal books and records?
No, I did not.
Did you ever meet with the Bureau of Securities Regulation prior to 2003?
No, I did not. I don't remember meeting with you, but I remember meeting with Dennis, so I'm not even sure if I met with in a meeting when they had the meeting.
Did you meet with the Bureau after 2003?
Yes.
Did you understand that there was a hearing with respect to financial resources that the Bureau conducted in the year 2003?
Yes.
Okay. So it's fair to say that you weren't working with the Bureau to redeem the unsecured notes after 2003?
No, I was not.
Okay. Who were you working with?
I was working with Dennis Maloney at Gallagher. He was the one that was coordinating that with Scott Farah to making sure that that was accomplished. I mean, the relationship we had between Gallagher and myself was, I'm just doing the audit, so I want to be able to, when I'm done filing my financial statements, is this, I was confirming with him, what amount of the securities were redeemed, not redeemed, at that point in time at the end of the year.
So you and, is it fair to say you and Dennis were tracking the redemptions post-2003?
Right.
Was there any tracking that took place in 2004?
Yes. We were, I mean, each year that I did the audit, we would be looking for who had been redeemed. And then, again, part of the evidence that I would gather would be the shares would be canceled, the checks would be paid to confirm that those shares were being redeemed or the notes were being redeemed.
Was there any tracking that took place in 2005?
Yes, same.
Was there any tracking that took place in 2006?
It was the same, yes.
2007?
Yes.
Okay, and when was the last redemption?
I believe it was in the first quarter of 2007.
What was your knowledge of National Inspection and Repair?
That was a note that came on the books. It would have had a part of the documents would have been a note balance of what was outstanding. I think it was at the end of 01. In 02, we had a balance that was still showing to be outstanding, and then it took on a litigation mode where from that point on, the way I would be viewing that was valuation of the asset at each one of the succeeding years.
Were you ever in communication with any officers of the company?
At NIR? No.
Did you send any conference to NIR?
No, I did not.
Do you know whether it still exists today?
I'm not sure if it's open or not. I have no direct knowledge of that.
Do you know what the company did?
Not particularly. Again, my evaluation at that point in time was, is the note collectible or not? So each year I would circularize the lawyers to tell me where it was in the litigation process. That was the other reason it was fruitful to confirm the amount, because the amount now was in litigation and it was only whatever that balance would be is whatever value they were going to be able to collect.
Were you aware that NIR counterclaimed against Financial Resources?
I think that came through on the legal letters, yes.
Do you know why they counterclaimed?
Not without reviewing the documents, no. Don't.
Were you aware that there was a dispute as to Financial Resources' obligation to loan money to NIR?
I don't recall.
Did you even get involved in the valuing of the unsecured notes owed to Financial Resources?
To the extent, if they were on the books, would be, yes, I had to come up with some kind of value, or they had to present me with facts to show what the value was on those.
And how did you value those notes?
The notes usually were either on the face value or the underlying security on the notes if they were non-performing. And in certain cases, like the NRI, it became from judgment amounts that were issued through the litigation process.
Was there any valuation that you undertook in the sale of assets?
No.
No further questions.
I have nothing further. Attorney Forsey, do you have anything additional?
No, sir.
Mr. Connor, I want to thank you very much. Before he leaves, the disc I'm going to receive is going to be redacted in a few instances. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I also had to give to you the purchase and sale agreement as well as the line of credit and series of notes, just so you would have a hard copy of it.
I was going to ask for those because that disc isn't much better than this. I'm going to have to.
This does not contain all the documents that are on that disc. If there's any that you've described to you what we'd like some of the confirmations or the engagement letter, we do have those in our possession, but for today, I gave you what I thought you would want, which would be these.
Okay. Michelle?
There's just one other thing I want to make sure I am clear on is for CLM, I never did any kind of accounting, tax services, aside from meeting Don Dodge maybe three or four times in the office. I did.
You've been very clear on that. It's clearly understood.
Okay.
You never engaged by them. You had no obligation. That's. I absolutely understand
okay.
that. No, no question there.
Okay.
Again, Mr. Connor, thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you.
We're going to label that. We live let Connor. I want his name
okay.
on that line somewhere.
Yep.
Okay.
We gotta go to the left side to get onto it.
Correct. Then click on this part to go through.
Oh, you gotta get on. I see.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Tepp.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chandler.
Mr. Tepp, you understand that any testimony you give in this matter will be under oath. Is that correct?
Yes.
Will you raise your right hand, please? You solemnly swear the testimony about to give in the matter now pending will be the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help you God.
Yes.
Would you state your name for the record and spell your last name, please?
My name is Carvel Teft, and the name is spelled T-E-double-F as in Frank, and then T again.
And for the record, Mr. Teft, would you please tell us who your employer is?
The Bureau of Securities Regulation, Department of State.
Mr. Forcier?
Yes.
You want to proceed with Mr. Teft?
I was going to give Mr. Teff the floor to give us his PowerPoint presentation on the Panguay subdivision.
Mr. Teff, proceed. But before you do that, why don't you give me a little bit of educational background on yourself and years with the Bureau and so on.
Educational background? When I graduated from college, I don't think I want to tell you that. But I was a finance and business major at Michigan State University. The year I'll leave blank, if I may. And formerly, I had worked for Xerox Corporation for 17 years in upper management, senior management. Came to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and started a business which was in telecommunications. Sold the business in the late 90s. And went into real estate. And a friend of mine suggested be interested in having me join the Bureau a year and a half ago, and I agreed, so that's about how long I've been
okay.
with the Bureau.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chandler, if I could just intercede for just 1 minute. We put this disclaimer up here, hope you don't mind, but we just wanted to make it clear to the public that the documents we reviewed were a portion of the available documents that we had at our disposal. The number of documents that were available to us was, I would say, overwhelming. I mean, we would need just months and months and months to go through it all. So what we did was we took a cross-section of what we thought was going to be substantially relevant to this matter and made various conclusions and calculations to the best of our ability based upon the information that we did review, but the caveat is, just so that this matter is fully understood, we did not review all information, and we feel reasonably certain of our conclusions, but cannot state that they are without some flaw.
Well, Attorney Spill, I fully understand the voluminous amount of evidence that faced you and your ability to make some reasonable expectations concerning that. I fully understand what the disclaimer says, and I have absolutely no problem. In fact, I have great comfort with it. I'm pleased that you did it. And as I've stated many times, the rules of evidence strictly do not apply. So statistic probability is an issue with which I am not greatly concerned. And I think I am fully aware of your research efforts and what you have done and how you have done it and the level of effort that has gone into what I think we're going to see today. So I fully understand that, but I'm pleased to see the disclaimer nonetheless. Mr. Tech.
Mr. Chandler, we were charged with looking at, as Jeff said, a few of these projects that FRM entered into along with CLNM. And subsequently, we went to a couple of the county registry of deeds, one in Belknap and the other in Merrimack, to get our information. And we obviously were interested in recorded deeds and mortgages. And this is principally where we got our information from. So at the outset here, I just wanted to explain as a leave behind for you, what I've done is, for example, on the Tanguay project, which is in this presentation, is simply an overview in an executive summary form. I have pictures also the project itself, which is the planning board approval and what was actually built in yellow. And then this is a complete spreadsheet on all the documentation dates, recorded dates, names, and so forth and so on that backs up this executive summary.
Okay.
Which button do I hit here?
Right there should be fine.
Well, I'm right or left?
Right. Or left click it, left click.
Thank you, Michelle. Okay, Tanguay Homes, Abbott Village, it was known as, at 282 North Main Street in Concord here. It's a little on the north side up towards the prison. The owner-developer was Eves Tanguay. I saw a brochure that Mr. Tanguay had, and he's evidently over the years developed a number of these 55-year-old and year-old communities. And in the past, he may have done some financing with private lenders. I noticed also he did some traditional financing, bank financing, and in this case, with this project, Abbott Village, he obviously dealt with FRM. Did I go past the first? Well, anyway, a lot of the mortgages on the first mortgages on the units themselves were recorded 13 months after the date that they were executed, and we are assuming that these recording dates coincided with project approvals, in as much as you not only had to have planning board approval, of course, but you had to have approval from the Consumer Protection Bureau at the AG's office. The second point I'll talk later when we get down to that area. This, as I said before, this was an adult community, 55 and older. The AG's title for what you register with them is called a certificate of registration. That was done in 2006 for condominiums to be built in two phases. This project was recorded, as you can see, book and page at the county registry. And the Concord Planning Board did approve two phases on March 2nd, 2005. And they also approved a third phase. The total units that were planned were 79. From a first mortgage standpoint, which is the entire parcel, in this case it's the land because nothing had been built, the mortgagor, which is Tanguay in this case, of course, agreed to borrow $10 million over a two-year period between those dates, 06 and 08, from Great Land Project Development and SM 2007 Realty Trust. Don Dodge was the trustee. He also was the trustee of Great Land. And as I mentioned before, the entire parcel was about 15 acres. And that amounted to $10 million. Now, on the individual units that they began to build, a total of 26 townhouses were mortgaged, again from Great Land and other individual lenders. Great Land had quite a few of them, but there were some private lenders involved on the units, on the first mortgages. Only 18 of the 26 that were mortgaged, though, were actually built, 8 of which, it looks to us, when we went over and took pictures and stuff, were fully finished. And the current occupancy is unknown. In fact, it looked to me like maybe one of the ones that are built there now was occupied only. From a second, they also did second mortgages to raise more money, and these were offered on the same 18 units that ultimately were built, and that was a total of $873,000. And then Greatland interjected, TAN 2006 Realty Trust, another Dodge Financial Trust, interjected with $2 million on a second for the entire parcel. So that now the total for second mortgages became $2.8 million. The total value of first and second mortgages, from you know, my approximations, it was over $19 million. Dodge, who was part of this project, Greatland rather, he turned around and in order to raise money to pay himself back, I presume, began to assign these mortgages to 60, in this case it turned out to be, who are listed on our spreadsheet, of 60 individual lenders. So the assignor, Greatland, to the assignee, the lenders, a total of about $5.2 million. But this is sort of double counting, so I didn't throw that into the $19 million.
When he did that assignment, did you find any partial discharges of mortgage on record or anything of that nature?
No.
So no. So this occurred without partial discharges?
Yes.
Okay.
I didn't. Now, you know, I may have missed one or two, but I didn't see any.
Okay.
Now, Mr. Tangway, I was not here when he testified, but I believe he, I shouldn't say testified, but it was reported that he received, to us anyway, less than $5 million actually from the mortgage, the mortgages that he contracted for and to build out the 18 units. Between 2006 and 2009. None of these units were sold. The project did file bankruptcy recently and was recently purchased as of just weeks ago by a developer in Dover, New Hampshire. We don't know I was told, but I have not verified the price, you know, that he bought it for, but I'm sure it was a fire sale. What I wanted to mention here on this point that I didn't talk about earlier was the $225. I did find a check, or actually my cohort Bill Masick found this check in the FRM bank account that was made out to FRM by a lender. And in the memo section of the check, it cited one unit in phase two of Tangway's build plan. Interestingly enough, there was never any paperwork to back this up. So Scott Farah evidently took this money, this $225,000. I don't know if he gave any contractual or made any contract whatsoever back to this person that gave him the $225,000. But he cashed it, and he evidently told them that, you know, this will be applied against the Tangway project. Now, it's possible that CLNM or Don Dodge and so forth never even knew about that check. I have no idea whether this happened more than once.
The citation of the $225,000, citing that one unit, on the face of the check, you saw the notation?
On the memo section.
Okay.
Yeah. And so clearly the person writing the check, the lender, the private lender, thought he was lending money to that project.
So is it fair to say that what you found was somebody forwarded $225,000 to FRM from what you deduced to be an advance on a security interest on some real estate,
right,
but the result of what you find is that there were no documentations of any kind whatsoever relative to creation of a security interest or any kind of documents. Is that
right,
correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
And what we have learned in instances like that, there were a few lenders who gave him money on the come, and as long as they were receiving their interest payments, they didn't care until such time as maybe paperwork could have been generated.
If I may interject there, Mr. Tuff, that $19 million that you have mortgaged out, so this would indicate that there was more money beyond that $19 million that you said was recorded. So.
Right. Well, we come down to actually about $14.7 million in this case is unaccounted for.
Let's not leave this slide for a minute. Based upon your experience in real estate and the real estate market, is there any reason that an executed mortgage would go unrecorded for 13 months?
The only reason would be that you didn't have proper approvals, and that wouldn't match up. So you might be waiting for your final approval. But on the other hand, if the lender was concerned enough to follow up that it wasn't recorded in a timely way, which is like usually a day after, you know, the actual closing, the lender is sitting here with a liability, you know, not an asset, because obviously you can't make a claim that, on anything that's not been recorded. So these people were actually sitting out there with a liability for, all, say, in some cases, for over a year.
Thank you.
You want to get me on the, let's see, I don't know, on my next.
You want to go on to the next?
Yeah, I think we're ready to do it, yeah.
Do you have any questions on
this? No, I understand this completely. That's fine.
We're going to jump into the next subdivision.
Okay.
There's one more screen, I believe.
Oh, there is. Where's my, oh, here it is. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. We have a couple of pictures.
Okay.
This turned out better. Actually, we tried to show these pictures on our wall. We couldn't see them, but in the plan, there was a sort of a community center, and that actually was built. And then we did take a picture of these units, as you see. These are the ones that were finished, but they're not completely finished because they're uninhabited. And we noticed some wires sticking out from the building with lamp or lights, outdoor lights, and some of the drives and things like that had not been completed. And but this gives you an idea what the project looked like, and this is part of the 18 that were. And you can also see in the foreground here these, you know, these foundations that were supposed to be built. So that, again, that just reinforces the 18 of the 79 plan.
Let me ask you to suspend for a minute. I have a package that, is that the check to which you were referring?
That's exactly the check.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. Before we move to the next Attorney Spill, Attorney Forstier, do you have any questions for Mr. Teft?
I just want to reiterate, Mr. Teft. So you documented, or your estimates are that how much was the money coming for?
Approximately 14.7.
And that's not counting any additional money that may have been memoed to the Tankway project, but never applied or paperwork drawn.
That's right.
So it's at least $225,000, right. More than that. Or $275,000, right. More than that, right. In addition to any other ones you may discover.
Right. The only thing we could really track was when you go to the registry, you know, you have to put the name in, obviously, you know, the mortgagee, mortgagor, and the names of the project, and so forth and so on, and whatever's, you know, names that were associated with the project to see what had been recorded. So this is all, you know, this is virtually all we were able to find.
Thank you.
Let me just back up on my partial discharges of mortgages. You did look for those, is that correct?
Yeah, we found a few, but not on this project.
Not on the Tangway project?
No.
Okay. Fine. Proceed.
Right, I'll then move on to the next point.
If I recall, and it's been a few years since I've practiced, but Merrimack County Registry, in the recording process, in the upper left-hand corner of any document that was recorded, used to record the name of the individual to whom documents were returned when they were recorded. Is that still their practice, if you recall?
I'd have to look, because okay. I live in Portsmouth, and yeah. Rockingham County is pretty much where I did all my business, and I'm not sure about that. Just to make a point on that, obviously we kept and made copies of, to our financial detriment, all of the mortgage documents that we're talking about here. So we have them in the office, and I can look that up.
Let me ask Mr. Forstier or somebody to look at the recorded mortgage instruments in Merrimack County. The historically, the practice was that the entity to whom the document would be returned was recorded in the upper left-hand corner of the document. It may have ended. Who knows?
I think Bill might have some info on that.
Yes,
the
answer is
probably
yes.
Okay.
You remember that? Good. Good for you.
He also works at the bureau. He'll be up. You can ask him that question.
He's going to
be up in about 20 minutes.
Okay. Okay.
The second one that I'm here to talk about is Lilac Valley. This is up in Laconia, and Bill and I both visited this location. And in this case, Lawrence Baldy was the trustee originally, and we're not sure about his ownership and his interest in this. It was told to us in some cases, in some projects, he was an owner along with FRM, but in this particular case, he's just listed as a trustee. The scope of this project were 60 manufactured housing units planned on approximately 49 acres. This is the tax map and 478 and block 20 and so forth, lots of 1 and 2, which were combined, are shown up there. We saw that, and I made a copy of that. The subdivision plan was approved in February of 2007 by the Laconia Planning Board. And this particular subdivision did not require approval from the New Hampshire AG Consumer Protection because it was not planned as a condominium project. It's exempt. And so they were able to go ahead if they were able, if they could. The Lilac Valley 2007 Realty Trust, which was the mortgagor in this case, and Great Land Project Development, the mortgagee, began with $1.9 million. A second position was a private lender by the name of Rico Cheng and his revocable trust, and that was for $560,000. A third position was Mr. Terrence McKenna, and that was for $387,000. GCX Capital Trust LLC was for $387,000. I believe GCX Capital Trust is Mr. Gary Coyne. The total borrowed, the total addition there is $3.2 million. These also were assigned, for the original $1.9 million was assigned to, part of it was assigned back to a gentleman by the name of Raymond Klepper for $255,000. And Dodge Financial for 1.6, so the whole 1.20 was reassigned in those two instances.
Do you know what Dodge Financial is?
No.
Okay.
A trust, but not.
It's Dodge Financial Trust, in other words.
Yeah.
Okay.
The reported expenditures, according to Mr. Baldy, the builder engineering costs were around $500,000. Infrastructure costs were $250 for a sewer line. In this case, only two homes were built. The modular homes were estimated to originally cost $100,000. Only one home was sold, the other was developed, but leased. So we've estimated the total expenditures to be about $1 million. I believe, if I recall, the land here was leased on a 99-year lease basis, so you really didn't own the land itself. So in this case, roughly $2.2 million was unaccounted for.
In that particular instance, when you had the one house being sold and you thought the value was about $100,000?
No, to build.
Oh, okay.
That was the cost to build that we estimated. We were told by Mr. Baldy.
But it was sold?
It was sold.
Did you confirm that through
the industry? Yeah, we didn't confirm that through the register. We saw both houses occupied, and they could have done that through traditional financing, and we wouldn't have been able to find it right away. I mean, we don't know who the owners are.
Okay, where I was going is I was wondering if we had sufficient mortgage discharges to clear the title for that one sale.
I can't. I can't respond to that right at this point.
Okay, fair enough.
Whoops. The notes I've made, we obviously, there was a little additional infrastructure. In other words, we didn't see any roads. It was very rough terrain. It was uneven terrain. It didn't look like, you know, the site plan had really been pushed out very much. Currently, Brady Sullivan Properties came in a bankruptcy sale, and Stephen Nottinger was the trustee for Susan Farah and Tim Smith, trustee for Lilac Valley. They were co-owners, I guess. And the land, well, I mentioned the land that had been leased to the all buyers, not sold. But Brady Sullivan has bought the parcel and is, I guess, planning to develop it.
Do you know what they purchased it for?
I think they purchased, I heard they purchased it for like $400,000.
Okay. You didn't see any document with transfer tax on it?
I think that was Beaver Pond.
Was that Beaver Pond? Okay, I've got that. Pardon me, no, we did not see any transfer documents. And in fact, where we learned this was a little circuitously, so we didn't see the actual numbers. In one case, the next one, where Beaver Pond that was sold also to Brady Sullivan, he we actually, at the AG's office, when we were looking at the approvals, we actually saw his bid, and in fact, he paid the tax liens and bought the property for the $400,000. That's the one I got mixed up by.
That's the Beaver Pond property?
Beaver Pond. That's okay. The next one.
So this one was not sold out of bankruptcy?
It was sold out of bankruptcy, but we don't know what the price was. You know, when I say, Steve, it said, yes, all we read was down at the office of Nottinger was these they represented the Susan Fair and Tim Smith in the sale.
Getting indication from the crowd that it was sold for $800,000.
Well, we can certainly look at the any recorded document and extrapolate from the transfer tax and to see what was paid on that. So
okay,
and I maybe we should do that.
Will do.
Thank you. Please continue, Mr. Tech.
Okay, and here's a picture, so to speak. You can sort of make out two houses there. They're modular homes, you know, and they're virtually on a main road. There was another home behind there, the third home, but we couldn't tell if it was part of the project or not. Evidently, according to the documents, it wasn't. It was just there.
Where precisely is this?
Laconia, it's going... what route were we on? Was it going out 25, was it? No?
Well, I'll find it.
Yeah.
Never mind. I'll find it.
Actually, let's see. If I look here, Province Road.
I know where it is.
Province Road. Okay. And that would be, you know, on this map I did for you. That would be there. Can you bring up Beaver Pond if you, unless you don't want to have any questions?
I have no further questions. Mr. Spill or Mr. Forsey, any additional questions?
No, sir. I'm going to help him pull up the next
one. Please do. I'm not going to.
Beaver Pond.
The information that you took from, well, where did you get the information that appears on this slide, that Good Earth Revocable Trust has Michael Gould as the trustee, the beneficiaries of Susan Farah and Gary Coyne?
From that particular piece of information I got at the New Hampshire Attorney General's office on their submissions for approval for the project.
Okay.
I should just declare that this is Beaver Pond Estates, and it was on Roller Coaster Road in Laconia. And the owner states themselves as Good Earth Revocable Trust, with Michael Gould, the trustee, and as you can see, as you stated, beneficiaries of Susan and Gary Coyne at 50% each.
a company, Roque, I believe, I don't necessarily know the pronunciation, but consulting, produced a site plan, and that is located on Tax Map 127, Block 191, Lots 3 and 4. This was for a cluster housing condominium plan of 49 units on approximately 8.6 acres. This site plan was approved by the local Laconia Planning Board on August 8, 2006. There was a very strong effort, if you will, from the owner to get approval from the Consumer Protection Bureau, but they never gave them the information they needed ultimately, which were audited financials. And so basically during the period of 2006 till 2009, the attempts were made to get that approval, and it never was awarded by the Consumer Protection Bureau. Strangely enough, as you will see, the units were built anyway. As late as August of 2009, an attorney for FRM actually submitted responses to the latest AG inquiries, but that amounted to no avail. The mortgages recorded, there's actually six of them, so I broke them up in sections of three. Loan A, I could have said first position rather than just loan A, but as you go down here, B and C and so forth, it just indicates the position of these mortgages. And Richard Fucci was the first mortgage E, and that was for $375,000. Mr. Klepper, $175,000, and third position was GRH Realty LLC. For $700,000, I don't recall off the top of my head who was the principal behind GRH Realty. Maybe Bill might remember. Then on July 27th, 2007, some more loans. Loan D in fourth position was a $4 million loan, and that came from Great Land Project Development, Donald Dodge. Loan E was $930,000 from Great Land as well. So the total mortgages here were $6.2 million.
When you filed those mortgages, did you find any subordination agreements? Did you find anything that shifted anybody's position of priority in the lending scheme?
Not shifted, but we did find subordination agreements. We saw some subordination agreements. And I'm not necessarily able to attach each one to what I just said, but we did see some. The Good Earth Irrevocable Trust, is again, Michael Gould listed the appraised value of Beaver Pond. When he applied to the New Hampshire Attorney General's Office, the Consumer Protection Bureau, he actually listed it, the appraised value of the entire parcel for $1.3 million. I don't know where he got that appraisal. That was just noted on his submission. And it's not, we don't believe it's a tax appraisal. It was simply an appraisal that he got from someone. And of course, you can see that it was over-mortgaged based upon what he even said. Two condominium sections, approximately nine units, were actually built. We went up there to confirm this. We took pictures. Three were actually finished. It looked as though several might actually be occupied. And this all happened without the Consumer Protection approval. So I don't know how that happens. I don't know who is in a follow-up position to see.
But this is within the city of Laconia.
Yeah.
In the city of Laconia.
They would just send out their inspectors. But they had their planning board approval. But I don't know how the state operates when they haven't approved a project when somebody's actually building a project. I don't know if there's a responsibility to see whether they're building or not building.
In looking at these multiple mortgages that you found, do you have any indication, particularly in the two Great Lands, that those mortgages were in any way blanket mortgages that would have extended to properties other than what we see here?
No.
Okay. Okay. That eliminates a pretty big question.
The total cost here, as we understand it, the budget was $113,000 per completed unit. The infrastructure was approximately $800,000.
selling price was to be between 179 and 179. Approximately $2 million subsequently was actually spent. And if you do the math here, then we say approximately $4.2 million is unaccounted for on the, again, money mortgage versus what was actually. The current status, this is what I indicated to you just previously, that recently Brady Sutland stepped in on in May 4th, 2010. He bought the property. I believe he paid all the tax liens and bought the property for $400,000. And the Consumer Protection Bureau approved his application on October 15th, 2010. We saw their submission. It was immediately approved. And so he's ready to finish the project. Needless to say, he's well financed. Here's a note. The law, Rice Law Office in Laconia represented a lender who had given $130,000 to Beaver Pond and who had received several interest payments, but charged that the mortgage was never recorded and the borrower, Michael Gould, and so forth, was in default, and they requested immediate restitution. So there were some, here's another instant where something wasn't recorded we didn't know about, but we read a letter from a lawyer who said that, you know, charged them with not recording it. And there's another $130,000 that evidently went into the project or went into somebody's hands, but nobody knows where and when.
So again, I'll ask you the same series of questions. It appears, based upon the information that you gathered, that this lender forwarded $130,000 in some fashion to FRM, and there are no documents, there's no recorded mortgage. The only evidence, if it is even evidence of that, is a demand letter from the lender's attorney to Michael Gould. Is that correct?
That and the fact that it was admitted in that same letter that he had received, and I say he, it could have been a she, had received several months of interest payments, and they asked them to stop those interest payments. In fact, the note, the balance of the note that they asked for restitution was not 130, it was 127,000.
Attorney Spill or Attorney Forsyth?
No questions, sir.
This is a, unfortunately, picture that was unsuccessful from a car. We were using cell phones in this case. You might be able to see up here, this is kind of like a millstone that has Beaver Pond on it. And this is the new sign, you know, of selling the units. And we tried to get another, but that gives you a little bit idea what they looked like. Okay. And those were the ones that were completed.
Don't you find it odd that the city of Laconia hasn't, or doesn't appear to have been involved?
Yes. Coming from Portsmouth, New Hampshire, which is very involved in everything, this couldn't have possibly happened, so I don't know.
Do you know if the city of Laconia has occupancy permit process?
I don't know, but I would assume, I mean, you'd think they would. Okay. Occupancy permit, sure.
That's more of an aside than anything else.
All right. That concludes the three that I was to review.
Mr. Spill, Mr. Forsyth, any additional questions? I have nothing additional. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next witness.
There was one additional picture if you want to see it.
Someone do first, Bill.
Mr. Massick, give me a minute if you would, please. You can have to be seated. Yeah, I'm going to suspend for 3 minutes. Back on the record, the FRM hearing. The next witness we have is William Massick. Mr. Massick, do you understand any testimony you will give this afternoon will be under oath? Is that correct?
Yes.
Can you raise your right hand, please?
You solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give, and the matter now pending will be the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help you God.
So help me God.
Would you state your name for the record, spelling your last name, please?
William Masuck, M-A-S-U-C-K.
Mr. Masuck, do I understand that you're employed by the Bureau of Securities Regulation?
Yes.
Okay, in what capacity?
Auditor.
And a quick synopsis, if you would, of your education and background.
I have a bachelor's degree in business administration with a concentration in accounting from Newberry College.
And how long have you been with the Bureau?
6 years.
Okay. Mr. Forrester, is it my understanding that your anticipation is Mr. Masuck is going to have a presentation for us? Is that what we're headed?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Masuck, please proceed.
Okay. This is the flow of money transfers in Chichester Condominium Corporation. The owner and developer of Chichester Condo Corporation is Joseph A. Austin, president.
Could you just tell me the source of information for that slide?
Merrimack County Registry Deeds.
Great. Okay. Please proceed.
And to answer a question, on the top left-hand side at the Merrimack County Registry of Deeds, it says return to Law Office of Gould and Burke, P.O. Box 666 in Meredith, New Hampshire.
That's what I was looking for. Thank you, sir.
Okay, Chichester Condo, Chichester Condominium Corp., also known as White Birches, property overview, and this is located on Gatcher Road. On March 9, 2007, Chichester Condominium Corp. mortgaged units to Great Land Project Development, Inc. Later in March 2007, Great Land Project Development, Inc. assigns the units to the lenders. The amount of the units assigned were mostly $45,000. Okay. The mortgage paperwork was completed by the Law Office of Gould and Burke, and as of November 24, 2010, net value of the land is $338,100. 17 units were mortgaged, and it appears as if no units have been built. Okay, this is what I got from the tax assessor's office. And this is another view of it here.
Have you been to the site?
Yes, I have, and I took pictures. At the entrance, it says keep out, so I didn't go in there, but I did take pictures. It appears that none of the units have been built. Okay. Here's a picture right here. White Birches, this is out in front to the right of the entrance. Those are the keep out signs right there.
Okay.
And this is another angle from the keep out sign. And also the entrance, previously there's a car for sale out in front, so no one's in there going in there.
You mean blocking the entrance?
No, it's to the side. Okay. This is a certificate of registration from the Attorney General's, and it's just saying that it's been approved, and it was issued October 13th, 2005. Okay, this is what I got from the tax assessor's office, and as stated previously, the net value is $338,100. That's right there.
Did you happen to look at the tax card for this property?
I'm not sure what a tax card is.
Tax card is, well, then...
I called them and they faxed
it. They sent that to you. Okay, fair enough, fair enough. Do you know what an assessment ratio is?
No, I'm not sure
okay.
what that means.
Okay, fair enough. But the number that they have as the tax assessed value was what again?
$338,100.
Thank you.
Okay, and these are the first mortgages for the land that I got at the Registry of Deeds. Okay, and they're recorded on March 8, 2007. First one's for $328,000. The mortgagor is Joseph A. Austin, president of the Chichester Condo Corp. and the mortgagee was Bruce Gatchell, Elaine M. Gatchell, and Paul Gatchell. And there was another one for $50,000. The mortgagee was Laconia Savings Bank, and the mortgagor was Chichester Condocorp. And this deed was discharged October 3rd of 08. And the subtotal is $378,000.
So the $328,000 was on record when Laconia Savings Bank took a second for $50,000.
Yes, that's what it looks like. And these are the first mortgages for the 17 units. As stated previously, $45,000 seems to be the constant here. The mortgagor was Chichester Econocorp for all of them, mm-hmm. except for one, Joseph A. Austin, president of Chichester Econocorp. And the mortgagees are listed here on the right.
Did you find these documents yourself in the registry?
Yes, I did. I did it online.
Did you notice any mortgage discharges of any kind?
No, I didn't see any. I don't remember seeing any.
Okay.
Okay, and this is a continuation of the units. And here we see Great Land Project Development as mortgagee. And the subtotal was almost $1 million, $994,000.
And you've been to the site, and there's nothing on the site. Is that correct?
I don't remember seeing any.
Okay. And it's fair to say that if you saw something built there, if something was built there, you'd have seen it.
Oh, to the site?
Yeah. As,
oh, no, I didn't see anything there.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
Definitely not. But again, well, the keep out sign was right there, but
yeah,
right,
I see
there's nothing there. Okay, and there was a couple of second mortgages on the units. This one was for $170,000. The mortgagee was Donald Dodge, trustee for the SMM 2007 Realty Trust. And this one's for $30,000 on Unit 15. Again, the mortgagee is Donald Dodge, Inc., trustee for the SMM Realty Trust. And I saw a document, this was increased to $46,000 on 11607 because of an unpaid note.
That document was recorded in the registry?
Correct. And the subtotal is $200,000 for the second mortgages. Okay. And these are assignments, partial assignments of the mortgages for all the units. Total for that was $510,000. The assigner mostly is Great Land to individuals. And for the summary, the first mortgage is on the land, $378,000. First mortgage is on the units, almost $1 million. Second mortgage is $200,000. Assignments, partial assignments of the mortgage, $510,000, for a total of over $2 million.
Is it fair to say that that $510,000 on the assignments, partial assignments on your bottom line, those are all the from Great Land, is that right?
The majority are from Great
okay.
Land.
And again, I'm going to ask, did you see any partial discharges of mortgage from Great Land?
No, I did not.
So is it fair to say then, without a partial discharge of mortgage, even though Great Land assigned, they would still be in a position of priority to their assignee? Is that correct?
That seems to be correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, and notes. Upon information and belief, units should not have been sold as condominium declaration had not been recorded in the Merrimack County Registry of Deeds.
So what was in the registry? Just those plans that you showed me?
Yes, I have everything that I made a copy of the registry.
Condominium declarations of any kind on record? No approvals from the AG's office, is that correct?
There was a previous approval from Richard Head.
Okay.
And I did see some subordination agreements.
And
I'm not sure what a subordination agreement is. Well, I need to make a copy of it, though.
I am. Why don't you forward me one? Okay, let the record show that I'm looking at a utility subordination agreement that has no bearing on the project that, that we're looking at. So I'm just going to return. I'm just going to return that to you and ask you to continue.
And that ends the presentation.
And one more.
Okay. Before we get there, Mr. Spill and Mr. Forcier, any questions of Mr.
No,
Masick? Okay.
No,
I hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't have to actually click on this in the log and click anywhere.
Ah, okay. Okay, this is the Center Harbor Christian Church, property located on Colonial Drive in Center Harbor. I went to the Carroll County Registry of Deeds. I spent a number of days over there collecting documents. And this is a Center Harbor Christian Church property overview. In 2009, Center Harbor Christian Church deeded 10 lots of this 14-lot subdivision to Lawrence Baldy, LBSF 2005 Realty Trust, and LB Realty Trust. Financial resources, Scott Farah was a general contractor and supervised construction of infrastructure, two houses, and two foundations. Development location was good, with home values projected to be $375,000 and up.
Okay, before you leave that slide, is it fair to say that the information on that slide was gathered by you in your research at Carroll County?
And talking to Lawrence Baldy.
Okay, thank you.
The builder was Lawrence Baldy on or about 2009. Mr. Baldy was Scott Farah's partner on the project. Farah told Mr. Baldy that the project could not be finished due to lack of funds. Construction bills were submitted to FRM or CLM for payment. Mortgage paperwork was completed by Gould and Burke. Scott Farah would move Baldy around the different projects before homes were completed.
How do you know that? How did you come to that conclusion?
That's from the interviews that we've done.
Okay.
And also some of the documents.
You'll be hearing from most of these people.
Okay.
If not all.
Okay.
And from the bankruptcy records. Donald Dodge purchased the two houses built on lots 1 and 13. CLM collected $2,750,000 from private lenders through partial assignments on the 10 lots. Tom Holly was a site inspector and would approve the work done. Registry errors. The documents of the Carroll County Registry of Deeds were not accurate and assignments were not properly recorded. For example, descriptions of a property within mortgage assignments entitled Tax Lot 50 should be Tax Lot 40, and I was on the phone with them and they explained that to me. The explanation could be sloppy paperwork. And as I was doing this, and I was talking to the registry employees, they were having a tough time gathering the information that they had to do previously for someone else.
You're not implying sloppy work on the part of the employees of the
no,
registry.
No, not the registry. No.
Yeah, it's elsewhere.
Elsewhere.
The people
yes.
who produced the documents.
No, they were very helpful when
okay.
I was over there.
Good.
Okay, the land was divided into two parcels. The first parcel is a church, and the second is divided into 14 lots or units. Two foundations were built on parcel two. Rico Chang Revocable Trust lent money to Center Harbor Christian Church for the subdivision of 14 lots. Great Land Project Development, Inc. was the assigner of the mortgages on a number of the lots, and the assignees were lenders. CLM would make payments for the work completed through disbursement requests. Loan master reports displayed the payment history for disbursements and payments. Okay, Philip Kirkos of, I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing his name wrong, Kirkos Appraisal Services, LLC, whose license was revoked, was a supervisory appraiser for some of the units. And the Maine Board of Real Estate Appraiser revoked his license on March 13, 2007, and the Vermont Board of Real Estate Appraisers revoked his license in July 2007.
In your first paragraph, when you talk about his license being revoked, you're referring to Maine and Vermont, or are you referring to New Hampshire?
His license was revoked in all three states, Vermont, Maine, and New Hampshire. The New Hampshire Board of Real Estate Appraisers revoked his license in February 2009. Maine found that he accepted fees in return for preparing appraisals to match predetermined values of properties, omitting from appraisals aspect of properties that would diminish their values and provide false and misleading information on appraisals. So he was an individual associated with this project. Okay, this is a map. Says Moultonboro, New Hampshire, and even though it's in Center Harbor, I had to go to Moultonboro for this information. And these are all the lots. The church is right here, and as you drive, this is all built. These are all the lots that are associated with Parcel 2.
Is the road built?
Yes, the road is built. I drove up through the road.
Is it in its finished configuration?
The road?
Yeah.
The road is finished.
Okay.
Yes. This is a satellite view of the land. Okay, this is the tax map for the land with all the units.
Two units are built, you said, is that correct?
I'm pretty sure there are two.
Okay.
I saw one, but I think another one was up a path, and I couldn't see it when I drove through. This is one of them that was built on 39 Colonial Drive with appraised value of over $280,000. This is a video of me driving through the...
Can you double-click on the video and make it bigger?
Oops. Okay, this is showing nothing has been built on any of the lots.
When was this video taken?
Last month.
It looks like underground utilities are in.
Yes. That looks like the house that was built.
The one that had the appraised value of 280, 200 or whatever it was?
Yes, I think $284,000. And there's a church right there, and this is the entrance.
Just out of curiosity, did you ever happen to do any title work on the church?
The church? Yes, I believe I have that information.
Okay.
I think the appraised value was over $1 million. I saw. It's a picture of the, to the left is the entrance into the lots. This is another picture of nothing built and some utility. Another picture of driving up to the lots. Nothing built. There's one of the foundations that was built. And this is the other foundation that was built. There are two foundations built. That's the right of one of the foundations. Another one of the foundations.
And these pictures were taken?
The same day.
Within a month?
A month ago.
Okay.
Correct. And that is the end.
Thank you. Mr. Fawzi or Mr. Spill, do you have any questions? Mr. Masick?
No, sir. No
question. Mr. Chandler, I have all the information I collected from the registry of deeds, if you'd like it, and the tax assessor's office.
Let me see your registry information before we, and just to have a look. There may be something in there I might want to ask you about.
Sure. From which project?
The last one. The one with the church and their two houses. Just want to have a look.
And with the Center Harbor Church, I did see discharges of the mortgages.
You did not?
Yes, I did.
Oh, you did?
I did see. Yes.
Well, then you've answered the question that I'm sort of flipping through here for.
I think not for all of them, but for the majority of them.
Okay. So regarding the church, you found discharges of mortgage?
Correct.
Okay. But for other entities, you did not?
The Chichester Connell Corp., I did not see the discharges of mortgages.
That's exactly what I was looking for. Thank you. I have nothing further. Mr. Fawzi or Mr. Spill?
No, sir. We have one other PowerPoint to present.
Okay. Let's.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
Do you have these documents?
No, that's fine. You answered exactly what I wanted to know. That's quite significant, actually. Thank you. Mr. Fawzi, who's going to be presenting?
Yes, sir.
As an officer of the court, I'm not going to place you on the road, Mr. Fawzi.
All right.
I guess I'm going to. No. I'll shift back here.
We just have a few brief slides on National Inspection and Repair Company, Incorporated.
Let me just state for the record that. The next presentation comes from Attorney Eric Fawzi. I'm not placing him under oath. He's an officer of the court and obligated as an oath you'd obligate. Please proceed.
Thank you. Again, we're speaking about National Inspection Repair Company, Incorporated. They're out of Topeka, Kansas, with David Price as the registered owner. National Inspection and Repair is a Kansas-based corporation which conducts OSHA inspections of heavy equipment and dams. In the early 2000s, Financial Resources and Assistance of the Lakes Region, the predecessor company to FRM, made business loans and loan commitments to NIR secured by accounts receivable and by heavy equipment. Financial Resources and Assistance of the Lakes Region had several such notes outstanding against various companies, including Creative Couriers. So not only NIR did they have these types of notes, but another one, which we spoke about earlier, Creative Couriers, that was eventually sold to CL&M. At about this time, Scott Farah issued unsecured promissory notes to private lenders to be placed in what he called the NIR program, a factoring program. And as Mr. Connors testified, factoring is essentially the accounts receivable. In 2002, Financial Resources and Assistance sued NIR for collection of money owed to FRA. NIR counterclaimed against FRA for failing to honor the alleged loan commitments of FRA. Attorney Chris Carter represented NIR at the time. FRA's accountant Mr. Conger booked the NIR note in 2003 as an asset worth $717,984. That was a number I confirmed with him at the time, and we saw it on paper, but earlier today, he said it was booked at around $1 million. So there is an inconsistency there, worth noting. In 2004, FRA obtained a judgment against NIR for $300,000. Mr. Conner testified earlier that that number was $375,000, I believe, but he included accrued interest in that number. The judgment was appealed to the New Hampshire Supreme Court, where the judgment was upheld. So
that was, what, 2007?
Correct. It was either late 2006 or early 2007 that occurred, and it was booked into, according to Mr. Conner, at $375,000 with the accrued interest.
Do we have any explanation for the differential between the $300,000 and the $717,000 or the million? And was it prepaid? Was this the balance due, or was it some diminishment in the cause of action by counterclaim? I mean, do we know why?
I honestly can't
okay.
surely answer that question. Jeff, is there anything you can shed on that?
I think that was about the amount of money that was actually lent, and then it worked its way up to the larger number because of interest.
What I was really interested in, there wasn't some kind of a counterclaim that was a partial offset to a greater debt, greater than $300,000. So your belief is that, in essence, represents the debt. Okay, fair enough.
So, yeah, in 2003, before the outcome of the lawsuit, it was booked at $717,000, but in 2004, when they obtained a judgment, it was $300,000. That's the way I understand it.
Okay.
FRA issued multiple unsecured promissory notes in 2002 and 2003 against NIR factoring debt owed to FRA. One of the unsecured note holders was Jackie and Ronnie Stone. They were members of the Center Harbor Christian Church. Jackie and Ronnie Stone invested approximately $250,000 in unsecured notes, with half of that money going to NIR and the other half of the money going into a similar type of transaction with Blue Flower Inn. Some of the money belonged to Ron Stone's father, and he was managing that estate. In the fall of 2004, the Stones asked for their money back. Upon information and belief that we have determined that FRA could not pay them back until February 2005, when, in fact, that's when they offered. In the fall of 2004, they asked for their money back. It wasn't until February 2005 where FRA finally offered to pay that back, but not before the Stones filed a lawsuit in March of 2005. Chris Carter also, who represented NIR in the previous slides, in the previous lawsuit, also represented the Stones in this particular matter. So Mr. Carter defended NIR as well as the Stones against Financial Resources. In November 2005, Ron Stone contacted by telephone.
No, he represented the Stones as plaintiffs.
As plaintiffs, I'm sorry, that's what I meant. Thank you for that correction. In November 2005, Mr. Stone contacted by telephone the Bureau of Securities Regulation, complaining about his investment with FRA. The Bureau believed that the basis of the Stone's complaint was that Scott Farah had invested their money in a company that ceased to exist. That's the way we understand the basis of that complaint was. He was complaining that the money that Scott Farah put in was in a company that did not exist.
What did you base that on?
What was represented to the Bureau during that telephone call. We understood that he was complaining that Scott Farah had invested his money into a company that no longer existed.
That was his representation.
That was his representation to the Bureau during that November 2005 phone call.
Fair enough.
A formal written complaint was never filed with the Bureau with regard to that phone call and that allegation. During the November 2005 phone call, the Bureau did inquire with Mr. Stone if he would be filing a written complaint, and he indicated that he had an attorney by the name of Chris Carter that would deal with the matter through the Attorney General's office, and that they were investigating Robert Farah, the pastor of the Center Harbor Christian Church. In the spring of 2006, following a newspaper article that appeared regarding the Stone lawsuit, the Bureau went to FRA and spoke with Scott Farah and his counsel. Also in the spring of 2006, the Bureau obtained copies of the Stone's unsecured promissory notes and all other unsecured promissory notes related to the NIR program, and took out a cease and desist action in January 2007 with respect to those notes and all other identified previously. NIR was still in existence at the time, and the official records of the state of Kansas indicate that they were in good standing. and we have that document as part of this presentation, the slide coming up. According to those records, in November 2004, NIR lost their corporate charter for failing to pay fees and filing required documents. Their charter was, however, reinstated in March of 05 and remains in good standing to this day. And a document evidencing that is coming up.
Okay.
They for a brief time between November 04 and March 05, they lost their corporate status. By the spring of 2005, all of the NIR unsecured promissory notes had been paid back or rolled into secured mortgages, such as Apple Ridge. And to give you a brief...
Is that as part of the settlement process with Scott Farah, that he rolled that with the approval of the unsecured lenders?
The understanding was that he was to get rid of the unsecured lenders, but there wasn't no issue. There was no... Jeff could probably answer that better than me.
The hearing was in 2003. There was no decision. And the Bureau reactivated the case until the spring of 2006.
But by the spring of 2005, he'd already paid back or rolled into Apple Ridge all of the NIR unsecured promissory notes. Prior to that 06 meeting Jeff just spoke about, prior to that, they'd already rolled into.
But at the time of the rolling into Apple Ridge, at the time it occurred, all the unsecured lenders were made whole. Is that correct?
No. When the Bureau reactivated the case in 2006, there were still outstanding unsecured notes.
Oh, okay.
That were not fully redeemed until the first quarter of 2007.
Okay.
And that's what Mr. Connors testified earlier, that the first quarter...
I'm jumping
the
gun. We
believe that the NIR unsecured notes had all been paid back and rolled into Apple Ridge by 2005. But there still remained other unsecured notes.
Oh, I guess that's really what I was
asking. That's the distinction, right?
The NIR.
NIR, we believe, those unsecured notes had been paid back.
Yeah. Or rolled. Exactly. Apple Ridge, to give you a brief on that, is an undeveloped 117-unit apartment complex. There's raw land there with no buildings. It consists of 15.38 acres on two tracts of land in Laconia, New Hampshire. The SMM Realty Trust, Susan Farah and Phil Brouillard, co-trustees, acquired the property in a foreclosure sale in 1996. Included in the Apple Ridge rollovers were unsecured notes held by Wales, Miller, and Gates, individuals who have testified before you, consisting of a total value of over $1 million.
That's attorney Phil Brouillard, who's on the witness list, is that correct?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
At around that same time, FRA was working with counsel and the accountant that we spoke to earlier today to redeem all of FRA's unsecured notes to comply with the securities laws. In May of 2006, the Stones settled their lawsuit under a confidential settlement agreement resolving all claims against FRA.
And Chris Carter was counsel for the Stones at that time?
Yes.
And is it my understanding that he initially made a claim under the consumer protection component of our statutes, which we don't know how?
I can't answer that. Jeff, would you be able to answer that?
He alleged in his lawsuit against NIR, in his counterclaim on NIR, that the debt should not be repaid because the note was issued in violation of 421B.
Okay.
So that came up in the first lawsuit involving NIR, which was actually tried in 2004. And just to clarify, this has been a point of contention through this whole thing. There was a disconnect between Stone and the Bureau based on this one phone call. We thought this claim was that the company didn't exist.
Let me just state for the record that Mr. Spill is testifying, and he too is a member of the bar, and therefore does not need to be sworn. Please continue.
The disconnect was that we believed he was saying that the company didn't exist. I think what he was trying to tell us was that the company was not operating, or that was not continuing to operate at the time he put the money into it.
Okay.
So what we had done was we had checked the records in Kansas, determined that this was an actual company, determined that it was always a real company that existed under Kansas law, and except for that brief period in 04-05, was in good standing with the state.
So this is like a Kansas certificate of good standing?
Yes.
Okay.
This is, yeah, exactly.
Or I guess they're now called certificates of existence or something, right?
This letter was forwarded to me based on my inquiry to find out when, if ever, they lost their corporate status. And this was faxed to our office, and it is telling me that they lost their corporate status between these dates, but have otherwise been in good standing since their inception in 96.
Okay.
Now we're sort of looking at all the presentations we did today, including the money that was in to Manuki and Tinker Road development, which was a $3 million. The Bureau determined, based on its review of all the subdivisions, including the Manuki and development, total monies unaccounted for amount to approximately $27 million. And that was based, you know, we had at the end of every one of the presentations today, we had an amount that, you know, was mortgaged, and then we had what we did, the Bureau determined to be an amount that was actually dispersed. So there remained a difference of what was collected and what was dispersed, and that totals $27 million. And as a caveat, that does not include the money that was collected and memoed and checks, but there was no, you know, documents.
I was going to ask that.
That probably would make that, that's the low side without considering that. Those are recorded instruments, amounts. And
if someone were to forward $250,000 to Scott Farah for one of his opportunities and no documents were ever created and nothing ever happened and no loan ever closed, that $250,000 would not be part of your $27 million figure. Is that correct?
That's the way I understand it. Jeff, would you agree with me? We included only mortgaged amounts that were taken in, and we didn't include, you know, we wouldn't be able to include, we can't ascertain how much was brought in.
I understand
so, yes.
That, but I just want to be
yes, yes, Mr. Chandler, that $27 million does not include those figures.
Okay.
And that's it. We just want to sum up the total amount unaccounted for based on our estimations. And that concludes the NIR portion. Is there any questions that I may answer?
Well, let me have a look.
And while I have you here, I just wanted to put on into evidence a copy of all the presentations that were done today.
Oh, excellent. Okay. Shell, thank you. Anything additional you want to add, Mr. Spill?
No, sir.
Or any questions you want to ask of Mr. Force here that jumped in? I have nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we believe the Stones will be testifying.
Good.
As this progresses.
Okay.
So they can explain in their own words.
Okay.
What they felt the problem was.
Okay. Do we know if Mr. Carter will?
Not at this
okay.
Juncture.
I mean, I think. Appears to me Stone's more important than Carter at this point. But that's. Anything else to come before the hearing today?
No, sir.
Okay. We will stand adjourned until Monday at 10. Mr. Spill?
Can we get copies?